high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever the time may be, wherever you are across this great globe of ours, covered entirely by this program. And millions of listeners. Thank you, George, for the opportunity to get back in the seat. Of course, Premier Radio Networks. Giving you a quick update on a few things that I know some of you out there follow. My back is not at its best right now. It's supporting me about half the way, you know. So I'm in and out of that always. Ramona, my beautiful wife. Our four furry troublemakers are all just spiffy. And everything around the Bell home is well indeed. It's going to be a very interesting program tonight. Stan Deo's coming up in a few moments, and his wife, Holly, called me earlier tonight with a bit of a hair-raising a statement about a conversation she'd had earlier in the day, and I guess Stan has had as well. He'll tell you all about it in a second. A couple of other items. My gigantic antenna design is a total success, unless you count the anomalous conditions present on it and the 400 AC-DC volts, kind of a combination of AC and DC, and we're still looking at all of that. But in terms of a radiator, it is a gigantic success. Now, I did have one other giant project since I last talked to you. As you know, I have two 1,000-foot loops way up there in the air for my ham. Oh, speaking of ham radio, I was on there a few minutes prior to broadcast down in Los Angeles. They were listening, and when I go on ham radio with a kilowatt, why, it affects the audio that goes down to L.A. So they were hearing, and they called me up twice. You know, what is that? What is that? What are you doing? No problem. Just a little anomalous RF getting into the system. Anyway, I was talking to some ham buddies before I got on here tonight, and they said, gee, here you are talking to a few of us right now. In a few minutes, you're going to be talking to millions of people. And I thought, you know, actually, there's not a hell of a lot of difference, to be honest with you. It's just a microphone. And you never think of the people on the other side. You just think it's a microphone. Whether it's, you know, two or three people on the other side or lots of you out there. Anyway, my antenna design, back to that very quickly, 2,000-foot loops, 7 feet apart. And after we last spoke, last time I was here, I installed a grounding system which consists of a 4-foot-wide welded metal mesh, which I put immediately beneath the antenna, all the way around, 1 inch under the ground. And then I grounded it to my water well, which goes down 160 feet into the water. I grounded it to my tower, to all kinds of things. So that now runs under the antenna, and I'm building this monster. But boy, does it work. Incidentally, I am not dead. For those of you who have seen the website, it seems as though Nancy Leader's website ran a story, or more likely an email from somebody purporting to be an Associated Press story, which it was not, totally bogus, which reported I had died on June 19th. Well, many members of the press and others called me. In fact, my local paper here in town ran the story, which I think is on the Coast to Coast AM website right now, that I died. They ran that story. Actually, they ran the story of having called me at home, and I guess they got Ramona, who sounded, they said, cheerful. This is a riot. And Ramona put me through to the reporter right away. He said, you didn't die, did you? I said, no, and if I do, I'll call you first. And so I'm not dead. How that item got up there, I haven't the slightest idea. But now that I'm here on commercial radio, please, Ms. Leader, take it off. I'm obviously not dead. And also, by the way, obviously Planet X didn't wipe us all out either, so yo to the rest of you alive out there. All right, news of the day, not much of it. What gay men and women do in the privacy of their bedrooms is their own business, not the gov's. Supreme Court said Thursday in a historic civil rights ruling striking down bans on what some states have called deviant sexual acts. Strom Thurmond dead at 100. Wow, I thought he was never going to die. It seemed like Strom had, I don't know, almost eternal youth. He certainly had energy, and I'm certainly sorry to see him go. Strom Thurmond dead at 100 years of age. had just celebrated his 100th birthday. Authorities arrested one of the alleged al-Qaeda masterminds in last month's terrorist bombings in Riyadh in a major blow to Osama bin Laden's terrorist organization in the conservative desert kingdom of his birth. So they've got another one. Oh, by the way, Baghdad Bob. Remember Baghdad Bob? During the war, Iraq's former information minister who gained notoriety during the war for wildly implausible claims of victory, to put it mildly, went on Arab TV on Thursday and, get this, folks, stood by his statements, saying they came from, quote, many authentic sources, end quote. Mohammed Saeed al-Sharif did deny that U.S. tanks were in Baghdad, even as TV pictures showed them to be right there in the capital, in fact, in shouting distance. He would say, quote, there is no presence of American infidels in the city of Baghdad. Al-Shahaf asserted outside the Palestine Hotel on April 7th, Baghdad fell April 9th, in his first appearance since the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. An interview with an Arab satellite television network, he did not directly back down at all from some of his false claims during the war. Asked where he got the information, he said, from authentic sources, many authentic sources. And he said, and these also will be dealt with by history. So, I don't know what to tell you about that. He's still hanging in there. You got to give, you know, I'm sure he's going to end up showing up on some talk show. He would be a riot to interview, an absolute riot. Speaks obviously pretty good English, and you just know Letterman's going to have to try to get him on somebody. The head of the Brazilian space agency said his country is poised to grab a third of the world's fast-growing market for commercial satellites, launching them, thanks to a proposed tripling of spending on their space program. They haven't had a lot of luck yet. Most of what they've sent up has come down, tragically, but now they are ready to begin launching satellites, they say, commercially. Cloud-to-Earth lightning bolts. I got this from unknowncountry.com. That's Whitley's website. Cloud-to-Earth lightning bolts are a well-known natural occurrence. Now, scientists have discovered and photographed for the very first time enormous 90-kilometer-high luminous electric discharges that deliver large quantities of current from thunderstorms to the edge of the Earth's atmosphere. These are not the regular sprites you've heard about. The flash is described in a letter published in the current issue of the journal Nature, is believed to be a type of phenomena known by atmospheric physicists as, quote, transient luminous events, end quote. The other transient luminous event known as sprites and blue jets have been the subject of intense studies since the first one was photographed accidentally about 14 years ago. Nothing quite so large has been observed before. These really are monstrous. And you can see photographs of them. They're incredible. And you know, that's one thing about this antenna of mine and the anomalous nature of it with all of that voltage on it. There is a tremendous difference between the atmosphere and the Earth in terms of potential. Just a tremendous difference. And when you're talking about the upper atmosphere and the Earth, you get obviously a very large difference. And they're seeing discharges, I believe, of that sort of thing. A very, very interesting story developing from Channel 8 in Las Vegas. Apparently, an investigator's home, Area 51 investigator's home, has been raided by the FBI. Now, he had gone, this is up near Rachel, Nevada, not very far from where I am, and this man has been sort of, Chuck Clark is his name, has been demonstrating to the Channel 8 I-team in Las Vegas where Area 51 has been. Actually, they've been going outside of their own area and planting these detectors. And Chuck took the I-team out there and dug a few up, I guess, and showed them, you know, to them. And somebody somewhere didn't much like that. So they took a real good look at Chuck's home. And that's an ongoing story right now as well. All right. In a moment, Stan Deo, and he's got some pretty shocking stuff for you. Stay right where you are. You know, mention of the war, Baghdad Bob, reminds me to say once again that prior to the war, a good deal prior to it, during it, and after it, I've said to you that I don't know why we fought it, and I still don't. I don't have the faintest idea. Our men and women did a certainly outrageously good job, although they've suffered a lot of recent casualties, for a goal that I'm not clear about. Still no weapons of mass destruction. Now, maybe they're there. They may be there, but none of us have seen any yet. Earlier today, the man who investigated the mobile labs that they've been looking at said, yes, he was under a lot of pressure to declare them as tools of mass destruction, but says that certainly did not affect his final report. Nevertheless, the big ones, they haven't been found yet. All right, Stan Dale. Actually, Stan and Holly, because Holly is the first one who called today. Stan, though, has been a frequent guest on this program since 95 or so, as a beautiful wife and webmaster. Holly, 5 children, 8 grandchildren, and was born in Clifton, Texas, near Valley Mills, about 7 miles from the President's Ranch at Crawford. Holds both American and Australian citizenships, has lived in Australia for 30 years. Matter of fact, I interviewed him from Australia most times. But Stan and Holly returned home to Colorado last year, where he was once a cadet at the USAF Academy in Colorado, has held secret and above top secret security clearances. In 71, was recruited by Dr. Edward Teller's group to work on an ultra-secret aerospace propulsion project to develop anti-gravity. Read flying saucers here for a multinational organization who then sent him to their operation in Australia. In 84, while he was still in Australia, Stan did a joint lecture tour with John Schussler, currently director of MUFON, in an attempt to reveal what they knew about alien presence here on Earth. They were prevented from revealing quite a bit. Isn't that interesting? By the people John worked for at the time. You see, at that time, John, who is currently retired from the space program, was the project director at McDonnell Douglas for space shuttle flight operations at the NASA Center in Houston. He is the author of 2 books, The Cosmic Conspiracy and The Vindicator Scrolls, which are now sold in over 22 countries. Stan's Cosmic Conspiracy book has been translated into French, German, Greek, and has sold over 200,000 copies. Here from Colorado is Stan Deo. Stan, welcome to the program.
Wow, it's the first time I can say that I've talked to a ghost.
A ghost, yes. Here I am. The reports of my death and all that baloney.
I had the same thing happen to us down in Australia. We got a call one day from the New Zealand police, which is, of course, across the pond from us a bit, and they called and wanted to talk to me, and I said, well, okay, this is me. And he says, well, can you prove that you're alive? And I said, well, I give you my driver's license number here in Australia or something. And somebody had gotten the same kind of thing on the email, and so they called their local police to check up and see if it was true.
That was about like the 3rd or 4th time around for me, Stan, so I'm almost used to it. If you can get used to your death being reported, I'm almost used to it. Let's get to what's happening, Stan. Holly called me and kind of freaked me out earlier today.
Yeah, it was quite a shock to us, too, because we're not in a big city here. We're about 15 miles out of Pueblo, which only has 100,000 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Holly's been working to finish the new book here that we hope will be out on CD and a printed copy in a couple of months. But anyway, she needs to research something at the bookstore down in town. So we went driving down there, and the bookstore it's one of the bigger chains, and it had a section in meteorology, which is what she was looking for, was a wind map.
Told me she was looking for wind maps, yes. And that strangely, wind maps don't exist anymore. And they've all been pulled from libraries and other... is that really true?
Well, I haven't been able to check all the libraries, but this is what this strange individual told us.
The wind maps are gone. And now, I told Holly at the time, when we talked earlier today, that I thought probably it had to do with the current terrorism threat, and obviously if somebody had a book on wind patterns, they'd be able to determine, you know, what was a good point to release biological chemical agents and get the most bang for the buck. And I assumed that's why they might have been pulled.
I think so. I know that during Gulf War One, down in Australia, I was I'd just been getting information for the second book I wrote, The Vindicator Scrolls, and I was at the library there at the university, and there were no maps, save the Persian Gulf region, that were like better than 1 to 100,000 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed to get one of the librarians there who kept a private stash of maps in the back to give me a copy that I could photocopy in color that was, you know, at the right resolution of that area down to the wells.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And I asked him why he did that, and he said because two men in suits had come out from America collecting all the maps that were of a certain resolution or, you know, or below, you know, before people could access them on the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I guess the guy didn't have any reason to lie to me about it, and so I assume the same thing is probably happening here because of the reason you stated.
Mm-hmm.
But Holly was anyway, she was going in to look for this wind maps in the library, thinking maybe there was an old book published or something, and we contacted a few people on the internet that we know in professional places in the government, and those maps are not available.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't make them anymore. You know, strangely enough, they wouldn't admit to anything other than that. So Holly went up to the desk in this bookstore to get one of the chaps there to help us, and he came back over, and you know, she started asking about, look, I need a book here that has something to do with wind roses, you know. And he said, he didn't blink an eye. And she said, oh, well, look, you probably don't know what a wind rose is. It's one of those little dots over a city that has arrows going out to show the prevailing winds at certain times of day.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, I know what you're talking about. I know. He says, no, he's not going to find much here at all because all the books, you know, and maps and stuff of that caliber have been taken off the shelves and recalled across the country. And then walked off.
Well, then terrorism is but one possible example. I'll go out on a limb and speculate on another. The weather's going totally berserk, Stan. I mean, totally berserk. We have had the most violent season of weather in this spring that we've had in all of recorded human history. I mean, they're having melon-sized hail in Nebraska. They're having 60 tornadoes out of one or two storms. They're having. It's just unbelievable what's going on in the Midwest.
It is, and I think you've probably noticed that the sunspot activity, well, the solar emission activity, CME,
also going nuts.
Oh, like 10 to 20 times greater than normal.
Yes, it affects shortwave, so I watch it on a daily basis, and we have been in storm for just an unrelenting period of time. I mean, the sun is just really going berserk, yes.
And the planet's been heating up. I think we're at 0.2 or 2-tenths of a degree average Celsius across the planet, hotter than we were about 30 or 40 years ago.
So one could perhaps guess or just speculate that there is a massive change underway, and perhaps somebody doesn't want somebody studying that with the aid of wind maps. Just a thought, that's all.
No, you're right. When we get into what this guy told us, you'll hear a lot of that. You know, he turned out to be a rather interesting individual. He'd retired from Army intelligence.
Well, we'll get to all that in a moment after the break. You know, this message that you sent me from the director of FEMA, that's right, isn't it?
Yes.
FEMA's director, was asked a question about what do you see as the biggest challenge facing FEMA in 2000 and beyond, and he laid it out, the weather, severe storms, droughts, all over the next 10 years, extreme weather. And he wonders if FEMA can keep up with it and hopes that if they just keep doing what they're doing and do it better, that they're going to be able to keep up with it. But, I mean, inherent in his answer was a gigantic warning, if you read it.
Yep. Oh, most certainly. I'll tell you, that book that you guys put together, The Global Superstorm,
yes,
is probably going to become fact very shortly at this rate.
I would have put it a little differently. I'd say that it's actually well underway. Right now, Stan, it's well underway.
It's certainly laying the groundwork for it, no question about that.
Yeah, it's well underway. I mean, a permanent, at least from a nothing's permanent, but I mean, as far as humans are concerned, you know, we come and go in a blink of an eye. Mortality is is what it is, and we're here for a relatively short period of time. And so, really, from our point of view, it's a permanent change.
Yes, even the Hopi have been warning about the sun causing great damage here.
That's right. That's right. All right. We're obviously up to a break point here, so hold on, Stan. We'll be right back. And what this man in the bookstore had to say beyond the wind chart thing is extremely worrisome. It's one of those scary kind of things. So get ready. That's what's coming next. Stan Deo is my guest. A little later, Major Ed Dames from the High Desert. I'm Art Bell.
To be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memories stored and to use them to help us to
coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, filling in for George. Tonight's special guest host is Art Bell. To talk with Art, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. East of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. And west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling the AT&T International Operator and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. Now, for George Norrie, special guest host, Art Bell.
It's nice to be special. Hey, how's everybody doing tonight, huh? It's actually a great night. It's going to be an interesting night. Stan Deo with a lot to say following Stan tonight in the next hour. Major Ed Dames, affectionately known as Dr. Doom, with a whole lot for you. That's kind of the shape of the night. But what's immediately ahead with Stan is some pretty wild stuff. Just wait till you hear what he was told. Coming up next. All right, Stan, let's rock. You're talking with this fellow in a bookstore, and no more wind maps, but then he begins to spill the beans on a number of things. Now, maybe we should know, beyond being in the store, you know, I mean, who is this guy? What's his background? Why should we believe a word he says?
Well, we asked the same questions after we got out of the place. It was surely a random meeting. There was no question about it being anything other than that, but he was well-spoken, nicely dressed, older man, and there was even a little pin on his lapel that was off of the Kitty Hawk. That's not Army, that's Navy, obviously. But
Holly said he claimed a secret background of some sort.
Well, a number of the things that he told me and told us, I knew myself, were not widely known, and so I suppose I have to say, it's possible because what he says fits in with, what a lot of people who have been on your program talking about the future for the United States have been saying.
All right. All of that said, then, what did he say?
Well, Holly asked him, how do you know about the wind roses and stuff? And he says, we saw them in our research and information gathering. And she says, who's that? And he said, he got a little bit kind of lower voice. And he said, I used to work in Army intelligence. In fact, I was working for Sturm and Norman in the Gulf War I.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, oh, yeah. anyway, he says, we were running scenarios, war games here on American soil for future conflicts here on our soil. And something that we saw, and I won't explain any further than that, he said, told us that we needed to withdraw all the wind maps for the major cities of the United States. And we said, oh, you mean like for biological warfare stuff and nukes? And he said, no, for another reason. And we couldn't get that out of him. And he said, we studied things like tsunamis and coastal subsidence, sudden subsidence due to earthquake activity. And he said, you'll notice that we had signs put up all along the West Coast saying this is a tsunami flood area, caution. And so when we give the warning, that people won't go into those areas.
You know, I haven't seen those. On the other hand, I don't spend a lot of time at the coast. But a lot of our listeners say along the California, Oregon, Washington coast, you're saying they should be on the lookout, that they would see some signs.
Yep.
What do they look like, do you know?
Just a second. Did they tell us what those signs look like, Holly? You know those signs that, along California, the how did the signs look? What did she say? Small, probably 6 to 7 inches wide, about 3 or 4 inches tall. They're not big signs,
uh-huh.
If you get my drift. But he said, look, we ran a scenario on the death toll and damage to the United States should the tsunami activity become as great as we think it will.
Mm-hmm.
Our best scenario showed only 100,000 people died in California. That was the best, he said. And the worst was that, well, we would lose 75% or so of the population on the West Coast. And he said, yeah. Instead of Sacramento, we're going to call it Lake Sacramento because
Lake
there's
Sacramento.
Only 16 inches of rubble separating it from the sea.
And so he's talking about an earthquake.
He certainly is.
And a tsunami to follow.
And volcanoes. He ran the whole gamut of stuff like that. Of course,
the beginning of violent earth changes. That's what he was talking about.
Exactly. Exactly.
Did he give any time frame?
That's funny. Holly asked him. She, you know, she's subtle. She says, well, okay, when's it going to happen? When's it going to start? So then he changed the subject, went to telling us some other stuff. And she waited a couple of minutes, and she came back and said, yeah, I know, but you didn't answer the question. I said, when? And this went on. To the third time, finally, he said, actually, from right now until the year 2020, we're a threat from all these things. It could happen tomorrow or sometime between now and then.
Holly'd make a good talk show host. So we'd have to keep battering away.
She does.
So it, from right now, beginning right now, through 2020?
Yep. 17 years or so.
The next 17 years.
And this guy, look, he was a bright fellow. He's apparently at university. He and his young compadres were put into a think tank. And what they came up with for the future of the United States involved that we'd be in a major Middle East war by the end of the century. Of course, we're there now, or have been anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's not over yet.
Right.
But, and then they predicted other things for the United States, including a breakout of anarchy due to a number of factors that are primarily driven by geological factors. And I said, well, you're talking like a survivalist, or, you know. He said, well, we're prepared at our house. We've got the food and water and everything else put away for 6 months, no less than 6 months. He said, famous saying, 2 or 3 days, forget it. They're just trying to soft pedal it. You need at least 6 months because FEMA's not going to be able to get to you for under 6 months when this stuff hits. There won't be government help, so you're going to have to help yourself. And I said, oh, well, store a little extra for your neighbor so they have something to eat, too. And he said, no, I'm storing extra bullets.
Well,
so, anyway.
You know, I here where I live, you know, I'm kind of out in the country. And
yeah.
Your first line of protection is yourself. And so if you don't have guns, if you don't have your own protection, then the only person you're kidding is yourself. Because, you know, police are 20 minutes away. You know, they're far enough away so that if something really happened, they arrive in time to draw your outline in chalk on the floor.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you protect yourself. So I'm a big believer in that. A lot of people stocked up for Y2K. They should keep those things usable and handy because any number of things could happen. But this sounds pretty serious. He hit you with enough information that you know from other sources that you give him a pretty high credibility.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know whether we'll get to talk to him again or not. We kind of left the door open for him to come back. But, look, we got into things, just extraordinary things. There's not enough time to talk about today, but things like they know about the ancient alien presence on the planet and the current alien presences, the different races.
Really?
He was telling me about the Stargate that wasn't really to other stars, but to parallel dimensions that they had back in the old days, you know, in the Sumerian gods days, that kind of stuff. I mean, things that, you know, you and I, Linda Moulton Howe, a few of them, I mean, we know about this kind of stuff. And he was rolling off things.
Well,
like,
we know about it theoretically. We
well,
I could not direct you to the nearest Stargate, you know. We know about it theoretically.
I've seen a stone carving of what we think is the Stargate. It was around 640 BC, 600 BC, something like that. I'd have to look at my notes, but it was on a stone carving made in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and it showed the Tower of Babel. And there's enough left on the stone, we enhance the photos to look at it. You can see a circular glowing ring on top of it, and then a smaller ring or globe in the center of it, and had long steps where the gods walked out of the ring and down to the ground. And that was the Tower of Babel.
Mm.
Now, that was the oldest contemporary drawing or illustration of the tower we could find. But, you know, I looked at that a long time, and I understand from my own research kind of equipment that we would probably have to build would be toroidal coils and pulse them with a lot of energy and build up a field that we could walk through to the parallel, like the parallel universe, which is like shells of energy around the Earth.
And you really think something of that sort could be used to construct a virtual Stargate?
Well, as I say, not to other star systems, but right here in our local area, but to a higher energy density, like I think the esoterists call it planes of existence, but it's what Einstein called it was concentric shells of existence.
Huh.
Share the same space, but at different frequencies, so our matter passes between each other.
Right.
The breathing and exhaling of it, you know, inhaling, exhaling of the planet, if you wish, that growing and condensing. And that's fairly hard to explain.
Do you have any conceptual idea in your mind of what one might step through to on the other side if one really could pass through one of these gates?
Yeah. From the other old records that we have been able to help translate, we're seeing that, in fact, you can see it in a lot of the old Hebrew writings, that whenever a godlike being or angels or whatever came through, they came through on high places usually, and there was fire and boiling clouds around them. Like the density of the energy on their molecules, where they come from, is so much greater than ours that just their very atoms of their body and the air around them
mm-hmm.
burn our air when they come in until they either normalize to our energy density or because there's a shield around them or something. Remember when Moses was talking to God?
What does that mean? If we were to walk through on the other side, we arrive with icicles or what?
Well, I think we might walk into an oven. I wouldn't want to walk in just like that. I mean, I'd probably want to do like they do in the TV series and send a probe through first and see if I can get anything back. But
absolutely.
And if you go down a layer, an energy level underneath us, it
yes.
might be where, you know, the ghosts and other spirits have said to come from.
Well, you know, that's funny. I was about to ask you if you think this is the equivalent of what we loosely call heaven and hell.
Yeah. Except I'd say there's probably at least seven layers of existences, and we're probably on number six with seven beneath us and five above us.
And you think we're that close to heaven, do you?
There's five above us. That's a long...
Oh, five above us. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought there was just one above us.
No.
Just doesn't feel that close, you know?
Look, it's exciting stuff. And this guy was telling us things about the South Pole and the aerial or satellite photography they have over the South Pole where they have large circular ring structures that are now showing as the pole cap is melting and some of the advanced technology found in digging the ice there.
Indeed, it is melting. I saw a military report that indicated there's going to be a new ocean up there, and they need
yep.
to learn how to navigate.
Yep.
A lot of strange things are going on. There was another story about the caps on Mars melting. That one got me, because I thought, you know, if they're melting over there on Mars, then what about us, third rock from the sun, right?
Well, not only are the caps melting, but the sea is rising. And the reports show that we'll either get 20 feet or maybe 120 to 200 feet, depending on which expert you read. But our sea level is going to rise, and just a foot or two is going to make damage all along the coastal areas. And there are maps on the Internet from USGS and a few other folks showing which coastlines are in danger from subsidence or from the tsunamis from the ocean rising up and being very stormy.
And the other worrisome thing for me has always been that those who claim to see, whether it's by remote viewing or it's by psychic sense like Gordon Michael Scallion or people of that caliber, while they differ to some degree in what they say, they really kind of agree on more or less what you're saying right now as being our rather immediate future.
Yes, even the Hopi that gave us. When Holly and I went down there, they told us some of the things they don't tell the outside world because of something strange that happened there between us. But anyway, they took us to the edge of a cliff on Second Mesa and said, look down and see First Mesa and Third Mesa where the other parts of the Hopi Nation live.
Mm-hmm.
It was several thousand feet down, and I looked down there, and I said, yeah, desert, yeah, right. And he said, soon, we will go between these mesas by canoe.
Huh.
Now, that's in northeast, Arizona.
I, too, actually had the honor to do a program with Hopi elders. I think you may recall that one in which there had to be translation going on during about the whole program. And they echoed just many of the same things, Stan. And I asked them, I said, well, why are you coming on the air? I mean, this is not normally something you discuss with any kind of press at all, much less come on a live radio program. And their answer was, because there's not enough time.
Yeah, well, I'd believe that. I really would believe that. The Hopi elders told us down there that my visit there, one of the young chief's son's wife had seen my face several weeks before we got there,
mm-hmm.
and we weren't invited until we actually got into Arizona. We didn't even know where we were going. And they said that I was the fifth of eight messengers that they would get before the fifth world would begin, the fourth world would die, and before Phoenix becomes a seaport, obviously. The thing that they were trying to impress upon us was that the next three messengers were going to come quickly, because all the other signs that they were looking for with the power lines that were like spider webs going across the Hopi Nation and various other things were happening. And the good part about it, if there is such a thing, is they said there's going to be tremendous civil war in the United States.
That was a good part?
Well, after it's over, the survivors are going to come and meet with the Hopi and with the Navajo.
Yes.
And they will form a new tribe. There will be a lot of friction as they form and get direction, but they will then move up just beyond the Four Corners, probably up here in Colorado where we are, is what it indicated. And we found a valley over here, was a sacred valley called Beulah Valley, and the old Indian Trail goes all the way down to Four Corners. There's arrowheads and stuff laying up there to this day.
So, Four Corners going to be part of the ocean, or still Four Corners?
I don't know. The
it's got to be close.
Well, you'd think so. You'd think so. This guy and the Hopi say none of them had anything really, enjoyable. I mean, as far as the United States staying intact, but there will be survivors and there will be a new nation, and it will center somewhere here in Colorado, apparently, where they rebuild.
Even Stan, the New Age types that I've interviewed over the years,
yeah.
They talk about the wonderful, joyous hand in hand, peaceful future that humanity will have, and they dwell on that, of course. And then, but if you pin them down and you say, but yes, but what happens before that, they say, well, many will die. Well, how many are you talking about? Well, millions and millions are
going
to die.
Hundreds of millions,
even or even most of the present population will expire before this period comes. So I don't know. I just, too many people saying the same sort of thing to ignore it.
Well, I agree. This guy coming up to us in a store just cold like that and then just starting to unfold all the stuff before us, you just kind of think, this can't happen. This is a sleepy little town here in southern Colorado. You don't meet guys like this.
Stan, assuming that all of this is correct, and just for the sake of conversation, that our government became aware of this coming catastrophic worldwide event, what do you think a government, the most powerful government on the face of the globe, ours, the U.S. government, would do?
Well,
would they issue warnings, Stan?
I think they will at a certain point. They've already, apparently, a lot of the things that we think are prison camps, they say, are are going to be survival camps, that they're going to have the fences up to protect the people from, you know, other looters or whatever coming. But they say that the government, they maintain that the government will stay here and not go to Europe, and that if enough of government is left to govern like that. But
I've heard a lot of reports, Dan, of what some people call concentration camps, and reports that pilots have seen them from the air. And frankly, I thought it was a bunch of ultra right wing claptrap.
Me too.
But you know, there must be something out there. Where there's smoke, there's a little bit of fire. And so, yes, there might be something out there that we're not generally aware of.
Well, I tend to believe, you know, that these centers are being set up to help folks. I mean, look, when this kind of a catastrophe hits, we're going to have wild animals roaming in bands to eat, and wild dog packs and bears. And, I mean, we've already got them coming down from the hills here because of the weather
mm-hmm.
as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not convinced that our government's trying to do a nasty on us. I just can't see the value in it.
The other hand, though, their rationale might be, if something like this was going to happen again, just for the sake of conversation, there would be no point in essence, warning people, because the amount of panic and then death that would result as, you know, because of that panic, simply wouldn't be worth it. It simply wouldn't be worth it, because essentially, where are you going to run?
I know, to these camps, I guess, but they weren't planning on a lot of survivors from what he said. And if that asteroid, that's another story over on the East Coast there.
What asteroid?
Oh, yeah, well, from a number of other people who are having dreams and visions from across the spectrum, we get quite a bit of this. And I asked him about what we had heard, and he would neither confirm nor deny. I said, "Well, would they officially tell us?" And he says, "Well, I'm not sure." Uh-huh. And apparently, from all the data that's been collected, it's going to hit in the North Atlantic and make a tsunami all the way up into the Appalachians, about 1,200 feet altitude above sea level, and wipe the whole East Coast. And if you look at the USGS maps, the zones they've marked are right where they talked about this flash occurring.
All right, brother. Listen, we're out of time.
Okay.
I really appreciate your coming on and telling everybody about this, including me tonight.
Hey, no problem. Tell Ed I said hi.
And you stay in touch with this program. If you get more on this, we want it right away. Me or whoever's here, all right?
You bet.
You have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Stan Dale. Coming up in a moment, the glasses get a little rosier. Major Ed Dames, I'm Art Bell.
To coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Filling in for George, tonight's special guest host is Art Bell. To talk with Art, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. East of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. And west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling the AT&T International Operator and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. Now, for George Norrie, special guest host, Art Bell.
Easily the most loved and hated guest that I've ever had on the air, Major Ed Dames. Major Ed Dames, a retired military officer, was a remote viewing instructor for the U.S. Armed Services. I've seen his entire military record. I can tell you right now, he did exactly what he said he did for exactly whom he said he did it for. He instructed in our government's now admitted remote viewing program. That's what he did. Our government spent $20 million on remote viewing over many, many years, actually decades, I guess. And though in the end they denied that it was effective, they sure spent a lot of money and an awful lot of time investigating something they eventually concluded was not effective. There were, however, endless examples of why it was indeed effective, and the end of it was mostly political. So coming up in a moment, if you'll stay right where you are, we call him affectionately Dr. Doom. He acquired that earlier in his career, not certainly from me. Major Ed Dane, stay right where you are. Loved and hated, that's the mark of an effective person. Actually, the world's foremost remote viewing teacher, Edward A. Dames, Major U.S. Army retired, is a decorated military intelligence officer and an original member of the U.S. Army Prototype Remote Viewing Training Program. He served as the training and operations officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency's Psychic Intelligence Collection Unit, currently serves as executive director for the Matrix Intelligence Agency, a private consulting group, and is a technical consultant for the feature film Suspect Zero. I don't know if you knew that, a Tom Cruise, Paula Wagner production. And he plays the role of an FBI remote viewing instructor in the movie as well. Shouldn't be a hard role for him, really, Ed. Welcome back to the program.
It is so nice to hear you grace the airwaves with your sonorant, if not mellifluous voice.
Yes, thank you. All right, Ed, lots of biz, but before we get underway, for those who might be tuning in cold tonight, without going into a giant description of what it is, there will be a few who don't know. So what is remote viewing?
Remote viewing is mind control. You control your own mind. I teach you how to do that.
Huh, that's an interesting way to put it.
Mind systematic control. ESP.
Yeah, your own mind, though. Purpose being?
The purpose being is to collect information. It's what we teach is an information collection skill. We turn the innate intuitive psychic ability that you're born with into a skill to collect information accurately, because out of sight does not equal out of mind. You can turn your mind to anything. Your brain is not the same as your mind. Your brain allows you to be conscious and aware, but it's securely connected in most cases to your body, and mind is everywhere, connected to everything at the dimensional level where things exist as ideas and patterns of information. So the brain's an oscillator. It can tune in any of these, any mind signal.
So a global, in fact, a cosmic consciousness, consciousness that is connected entirely. Is that a way to put it?
I'd rather use the word mind in place of consciousness.
Okay. I guess it's semantics anyway. But in other words, a consciousness that is consciousness, Ed, a power?
No,
it is not a power.
No, it's just, think of it as a field art, a mind field. It's just a field like electromagnetic field. It's out there. You can avail yourself of it if you want, and sort of like a scalar.
Are you really sure about that, Ed? In other words, I understand that. Well, okay, that was a fast no. I understand that you use this field of dreams, we'll call it, to collect information, or as a conduit to collect information, or as a library to draw it from, or whatever. But really, you haven't explored the nature of it beyond that fairly specific purpose, have you?
No, it gives me a headache to think about it. You know, it's too, I'm a technician. I'm not a theoretician. We'll leave that to the academicians to do. But we have to have working hypotheses down here where the rubber meets the road. I've been teaching and doing this for 20 years. Mm-hmm. You can't teach it without having a working hypothesis and a model. Okay, and the model works very, very well. Very well indeed. Lately, we use the term knowledge mining. We see that a lot. And remote viewing in many ways is the opposite of data mining, the internet. Remote viewing gives you access to direct knowledge, new patterns of information, new knowledge, where data mining seeks to screen through tons of data looking for new knowledge, new patterns. So we do it the opposite way.
I want to read you something, Ed, so that we can get it out of the way and hit you with it right here at the very beginning. All right?
Fire away.
Here it comes. It's it's an email, and it will echo what many said and requested that I ask Ed, and so let's do it. It says, "Hi, Art. I see that you are having Major Ed Daines on tonight. Last time he was on with George, he said," in quotes here, "when we start the war against Iraq, North Korea will go into South Korea, and it will be a trick. They want the U.S. to push them back, whereas they will set off a nuke that is already in place in an underground tunnel. As you see, as yet, this has not happened. Would you please ask Ed about this? Sort of made me angry when he says this and nothing happened. What does he have to say about this, Ed?"
That was my opinion as a strategist, Art, not as a remote viewer.
Did you make that clear in the interview?
No, I didn't, and not clear enough. If you would go back and listen to the interview, you could see that that's me talking as a strategist. This is what I would do with those, and apparently this is on the board for North Korea. But
you've said that for years, that North Korea would be the first, I believe, to use a nuke in anger.
Oh, that stands, and they're going to use one. They're going to use one of those nukes. They have two. They have two mounted on warheads, which is additional information. And as 4 months ago, I did not think that they were mounted, but they are actually on missiles.
All right. Well, so then to reiterate what you said, you're now saying, you said as your opinion, not as something you had remote viewed. And I would have to go back and review the program because I did not hear it. And so apparently this was just your opinion of what might occur with the onset of the war, I guess? Or
yes, that's what I would do as tactically if I were a North Korean commander.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're going to use a nuclear weapon, and that I stand by. They'll be the first on the block to use one. That would be a very sad, unfortunate thing.
It would be
sad. Yeah, they're not going to stop this.
Since you were in the military, maybe you'd like to take a crack at this. Should North Korea use a nuclear weapon, whether against the South Koreans predominantly or certainly and the U.S. as well, because, you know, we're right there, 50,000 or so in South Korea, U.S. service people, a number of them would be killed. What do you believe the U.S. response to a nuclear explosion in South Korea would be?
Well, it would mean the end, of course, of North Korea as a government. We wouldn't respond with a massive retaliation on the people. We would hit everything that even looked like it had a steel barrel on one, cylindrical, or anything that looked like it had wings, of course. So that would be the end of their government. But we would not be able to retaliate using nuclear weapons on that peninsula. Only a couple of nuclear weapons would be militarily decisive, obviously. Look how close it is to China, though. China wins any way you look at it. We cannot launch things in the direction of China for two reasons. One is obvious. They are a nuclear power as well. Number two is they're our factory. We're not going to want to bomb our factory. Everything you see around you says made in China on it.
That's right.
Boeing Corporation is now teaching the Chinese how to make Boeing aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
That's great financially in the short run, but suicide in the long run. So there's a couple of reasons why the war would have to stop very, very quickly. It would be a blitzkrieg on our part, and I have reason to believe that we're going to preempt. So we might be able to get one of those weapons, but they're going to be able to pop another one on the peninsula.
But you have remote viewed the fact that North Korea is going to use a nuclear weapon. Can you tell us anything about what you actually remote viewed with regard to that?
I mean,
how do you come upon the determination that these people are going to explode a nuke? What do you see that leads you to that?
If you think of an internet database search, we go in with the search terms that we use in our business are interpreted literally. We teach this in our workshops. In fact, I'll be in Las Vegas. If you'd like to see how this works, I'm teaching an intermediate workshop right up the street from you this weekend. Come in and the students can strut their stuff, where you can see how we actually set problems up and solve them.
Well, but if we're talking about the possibility of error, if I, for example, go to a search engine, I'll pick out Google, and I put in North Korea nuclear, space nuclear, I'll get a lot of hits. And maybe I will get a hit that if I didn't know any better and I thought it was absolute information, I'd say, oh, my God, they're about to blow up a nuke. But if I, depending on how I put it into the search engine, Ed, you know, poo-poo in, poo-poo out, right? And you don't always get what you're looking for when you go and you enter a phrase in a search engine. I assume remote viewing has the same potential difficulty. There's a lot of information out there in this cosmic consciousness floating out there, and who's to say that you put in the right thing and that you're getting the right response?
Well, we know it empirically. It is technical. You have to be very careful. That's why we teach students to be very careful. But the idea of the next nuclear weapon used in anger,
yes,
that was 6 years ago, and every time from the last 6 years and every iteration of that particular search term, that idea set up technically the right way, it points to the Korean Peninsula. A ground war, and then a ground war starting, and then a mushroom cloud in the back, and it's not a fuel-air explosive, it's actually a nuclear weapon.
Well, would our response to it include doing what we're doing in Iraq, for example, where we're now saying, yes, we're nation building, and we're going to be there for years and years. Surprise, surprise. I mean, what do you do with North Korea? It's a crazy regime. There's no question about it. I mean, they're nuts. So, yes, you can take them out, but then you've got a whole country full of virtual soldiers. I mean, they've been preparing for nothing but military action for as long as I can recall, since the end of the Korean conflict.
Oh, no, you're looking at an entirely different war. The only way that I can see the war ending and any future at all, dismal at best, would be for the Chinese to mediate and we subcontract the post-war cleanup to China.
Doesn't that give China a completely new place on the world scene if we allow them to do that?
Not only will we allow them to do that, but while we're fighting over there, you know, they will probably occupy Taiwan after a short blitzkrieg.
Mm-hmm.
China wins.
So you believe that ultimately China will get Taiwan back, one way or the other, whether it's struck through some sort of political deal or they take it militarily, you believe they'll get it back?
It's my belief, yes. I have not remote viewed anything like that, but my belief is yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess we should be very clear about your belief versus what you have remote viewed. I want to be very careful about that tonight.
In the future, I shall be.
No question, though, about the use of a nuke. Any sense, Ed, of how close it's getting? And I know pinning things down time-wise is the hardest thing a remote viewer has to do, but it's the first question that everybody asks.
No, I don't have any sense for that, although we could develop it, and I'll tell you how in a moment. However, my hunch, my opinion is that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is not, they're not going to give up their designs on having nuclear weapons. And it's a pipe dream to think that they're going to abandon nuclear procurement and stop nuclear blackmail.
All right, well, you just said it. A lot of Americans, Ed, and a lot of people worldwide think that the North Koreans are not stupid enough to actually set off a nuke, but they're developing them and threatening to develop them in order to extort or blackmail assistance money and other monies and technological help from the U.S. You know, saying, well, we're either you help or we're making nukes. Look at this. Look out.
Yeah. We will, just like the, we'll have a number of countries back us up on a preemptive strike. And that's how that war will start. We'll do the best that we can to ameliorate the 37,000 artillery pieces, the use of them on the border as fast as possible. But it's going to be a war of a different kind, obviously. Anyway, we'll preempt. We maybe will get one of the weapons, one of the devices, but we won't get the second one. That's the one that they'll use. That's the one half of the family jewels.
Wow. What's our future like? I mean, here we are, as I said, nation building in Iraq, and then perhaps having China nation build in North Korea. Is that our future? Are we becoming the world's police force? Because we're getting spread a little thin here already, Ed, to be honest with you.
Yes, as the Chinese well know. They're just biding their time. We're thin. I'm not a policymaker, Art. I was just like you. I was a soldier. My job was to watch, strategize, and follow, and develop the tasks that our leaders develop the tasks to implement the operations that were based upon our leaders' goals.
Mm. All right, well, then let's come back to what you do do. You said that you are developing a method for pinning down timelines in remote viewing. And, I'll give you a lot of points. I mean, a lot of people out there don't, but I will give you a lot of points. You forecasted years ago on this program with me many things that did, in fact, come true and or are in the process of becoming true right now. I'll give you that. You've missed a couple. But, I mean, this timeline aspect of it is really important. A nuclear weapon going off in South Korea, really important to know when. And you say that there's a method now you're working on for nailing these timelines down. How?
Well, we can't nail it down exactly, but we can narrow the window down by using remote viewing to describe the nearest significant event in time, significant preceding event to the key event that we're looking at.
And how are those seen? I mean, I could imagine, for example, a graph in which there are large events that are large spikes on a graph, and then some way to measure the time in between. Or
no.
And then how? I mean, do you look back at history?
No. What we do is, for instance, in the case of what we believe to be an absolute discrete event in time, which is the next use of a nuclear weapon and on the Korean Peninsula, what we can do as remote viewers, and it isn't difficult, is to remote view and allow the collective unconscious, the matrix, to provide the data to us, because we're solving for an unknown, to describe the most significant preceding event. And that may be, let's say, the assassination of a leader somewhere, or the sinking of a submarine, or something like that. So that when we see
would that event still be in the future that you're now talking about, the precursor event?
Wouldn't be precursor. It would be preceding.
Well, it would be then a precursor to the event of the nuclear explosion.
I'm sorry, I use precursors differently as an old biological chemical warfare.
Oh yes, of
officer.
Course, yeah, different
chemicals,
meaning.
Chemicals. Yeah.
Yes, but I meant as a precursor to the event.
Yes, that this is what it would be. So when we see that, we know we're very, very close. But to nail it down specifically, there are ways of doing it, but it's so much work that we can't engage in it practically.
Huh.
But this is close enough for government work to do something like that, for instance. For instance, I wanted to know what would presage the shifting of the planet's poles, which we firmly believe is a reality in the not-too-distant future.
Did you hear Stan Deo part of the program?
I did.
You did. His appearance and now yours are sort of meant for each other. It's a very good segue. I mean, an awful lot of what he had to say I should sit down and talk to you right now tonight about, and that is massive earth changes of the kind that will take millions of lives and, you know, send us back to the Stone Age or something close to it. I may be, you know, exaggerating a little bit here, but not too much. Ed, hold on. We're at a break point. We'll be right back with Major Ed Danes from the High Desert. I'm Art Bell.
to Coast and worldwide on the Internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Filling in for George, tonight's special guest host is Art Bell. To talk with Art, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. East of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. And west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling the AT&T International Operator and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. Now, for George Norrie, special guest host, Art Bell.
Moving through the field of dreams on a dark night that is your mind. Good morning. It's Major Ed Danes here tonight. And if you'll stay right where you are, there's some strange times ahead. Warning for everybody, if you can't handle this kind of information, there's one thing you can always do. Your radio's equipped with it. It's called an on-off knob. Because some of this could get pretty rough. I suggest you stay, the rest of you that is, right where you are. It's very interesting, actually, the way Ed says that he's going to be able to pin timelines down a little bit closer, and that is to look at one event, and then as soon as that occurs, expect or have the expectation the other event is fairly close. Now, it seems to me that remote viewing spans time, both in our future and in our past. It should be equally possible to remote view events in the past, shouldn't it, Ed?
Absolutely. Think of mine as outside of time.
Uh-huh. Well, now, here's what I'm getting at. I'm looking for the benchmark to understand how you're going to mark when an event might occur. You say, that really sounds like the Hopi, you know, when you see the blue moon arrive, then the following shall happen. It's as though they were marking time in the same way, or the Hopi marked time in almost exactly the same way. But I thought, well, gee, then, why can't Ed go into the past, remote view large events that put a big ripple in everything, you know, the assassination of a president or an earthquake or something or another, and look at one event, then another event in the past, and find a way to have a benchmark to understand the length of time between A and B, or B and A in this case, since we're working backwards, and then come up with a benchmark for predicting the future?
Well, time isn't quite that way, Art. I mean, we're dealing with two times. We've got time, when you sleep, for instance, you could go to sleep tonight and wake up a million years in the future and not know that, and you wouldn't have any idea how much time passed. Hmm. But you've got that idea of time in terms of your mind, and consciousness. And you have this linear time that we measure calendrically, the Earth going around the Sun, the Earth revolving on its axis, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So these events, it's better to take the event and look at them in terms of not geological times per se. There really isn't a good benchmark when you get outside of our galaxy, when you get outside of our solar system. So down here, what we're looking at is a newspaper-worthy, front-page-worthy event, that kind of thing.
Yes.
When we see that, let's say Madonna breaking her back, something like that, hypothetically, that we recognize that a major singer has had an accident. When we see that, then we're very close to this other thing happening. This is a significant preceding event that we can recognize analytically.
Hmm. I just can't understand how you can measure one against the other. What benchmark is there to understand? We're talking about Madonna breaking her back, theoretically, and then this other event, and somehow you have to have something to measure to say we will be very close, other than that's the next event. How do we know that's not 100 years after the first? You've got to have some ruler, some measurement, some way of understanding the time span.
We have to experiment with it. It's the only way, because it's a new protocol for us, and we have to experiment. Everything that we do when we do well is a result of empirical knowledge, experience, doing this over and over again, making lots of mistakes. That's the way science works.
You seem to have the remote viewing part of it down very well indeed, but not the time part of it. And so if you could nail that down, then I think remote viewing would be back at the CIA real quick.
That's not where I'm going.
Well, I understand, but I mean, they'd yank it back so quick that, you know, Saddam Hussein's head would twist around all the way.
Well, it's still it isn't just used. Predictive intelligence is only one aspect of remote viewing. That's only one, predictive intelligence, and that has not proven that useful because of this timeline problem.
Yes. Yes, that's what I'd say. So if you are able to solve that, you're going to be back in the gold again very quickly, because it's really the big problem where remote viewing is concerned. Not that an event will occur, but when it will occur. Now, there's another practical part of remote viewing, and that is locating things that are in our present timeline, gas canisters for the military, the sort of thing you did before. And there was quite a bit of success with that. You would think the program would still stand within our government and be funded with taxpayer dollars if even that aspect of it was predictably accurate.
We didn't have it down then. I've got it down now, but it took a long, long time to iron the bugs out. And while it was a baby, it was so controversial. It was such a white elephant within the Department of Defense that it didn't have a chance to really grow. I had to grow it outside of the military over the last 20 years.
Who really supported it? I mean, even to last as long as it did, it had to have some support as well as detractors, yes?
Well, you know, some of the general officers and the very high-level civilians that supported it lost their jobs because of their support. I'm not going to mention names on the air here.
Well, all I'm saying is there had to be support at some level for it to have lasted that long.
There was. I mean, Colonel John Alexander, who lives there, a mutual friend of ours, he was a big supporter. And
still is, by the way.
Yes, yeah.
John, a very, very intelligent man, who obviously has done everything he's told us about and a whole lot more, definitely gets behind the concept of remote viewing being valid, and so do a lot of other, of a very great number of other people. Now, a lot of those people, even within the remote viewing community, are not exactly what we could call Ed Dames fans. On the other hand, they're not much a detractor either. It seems a very closed community, and at most people would say, well, you know, I don't want to comment on Ed. I don't really have anything to say. I've asked a number of other high-profile remote viewers, and they just don't have a whole lot to say about you, Ed. It's not as though...
I'm not conservative, Art.
Yeah, I know.
I like to push the envelope.
I know, and they know, and they don't say, well, you know, he's full of baloney, he doesn't know what he's doing, none of that stuff. They just don't like the areas that you've been into, Ed.
Well,
instead of looking at the sort of thing they looked at and were trained to look at and still, for the most part, look at, you know, I've asked him, I said, why don't you look at some of this incredible material that Ed Dames is talking about all the time, and they all say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to look at those kinds of events. Why, do you think?
Because if they become tainted with those kinds of very controversial things. You can't be a conservative scientist or a technician or a writer or a radio announcer and talk about UFOs and talk about the grays and talk about crop circles and agroglyphs. You cannot do that and maintain your credibility. That's why. I don't need to be politically correct, and I am not. But my life is very interesting. It's getting more interesting all the time.
I bet it was really interesting in the military. I was there in the Air Force, and I know the military mentality, and you must have had a hard road to hoe, I'll tell you, with an awful lot of the military.
only in these arenas. As a training officer, I could get away with quite a bit. But remember, my primary job was not to use taxpayers' money to look at UFOs and things like that.
I know.
After hours.
Well, I know. But the reason you did it after hours, if memory serves me, is because during the routine tasking that you were giving your people in the position you had in that program, they began seeing things, and you might explain this, seeing things, understanding things about which they were not tasked. Now, I suppose from the military's point of view, that's the failure of the program. But apparently they began to tell you about these things they were seeing that either made them nervous or scared them or they didn't understand about our future, and they talked about them. Somehow this got to you and intrigued you, or how did it happen?
The first operations officer of the unit got interested in Mars and used Joe McMonagle as in an altered state. Joe was not a remote viewer per se. He was a psychic. And
Very talented psychic.
Oh, yeah. He served this country very well. But Fred Atwater, the first operations officer, started to experiment with Joe when Joe was in altered states give him targets that were off planet, particularly Mars. In Joe's books, he says that he did this down at the Monroe Institute, but in reality, it was.
You're saying these were officially sanctioned?
Negative. No.
Okay, now how did Target Mars come about? Certainly not from our military.
No, it was Fred Atwater, the first operations officer of the unit, who said, "I wonder what," and then let's see if mine's outside of time and space.
Oh, really?
So I started to experiment with that, and when I was recruited to be Fred's replacement, I became extremely intrigued in this. Very, very intrigued.
Well, I would think that even the military might want the answers to some of these questions, because some of them involve how remote viewing works, the medium in which it works, the way it works, what we are beyond our physical bodies. Even the military might be interested in that sort of thing.
Not really.
No.
That's not what we get paid to do. We get paid to find. We were an experimental unit. Secretary of the Army at the time, General Marsh, had blessed us with some monies and some time to prove and to develop the protocol so that we had a standard operating procedure eventually to be able to work out the bugs so that we could find hostages and terrorists and get inside of erstwhile Soviet missile fabrication facilities, things like that.
Well, I know this. The CIA is a thankless profession indeed. You never hear about their successes because they are successes, and the bomb didn't explode or the gas didn't get dispersed or whatever horrible thing might happen didn't happen, so you never hear about it. And on the other hand, screw one thing up, and of course the press is all over the CIA for a screw-up, so that's all you ever hear about. It sort of puts
Bad taste in people's mouths. Actually, the CIA coveted our program. They coveted our program.
Yes, I understand. But what I'm saying is, it puts a bad taste in people's mouths when it goes bad. So that's all you ever hear about. I'm assuming that even remote viewing was responsible for some of the CIA successes that we never heard about, and you probably can't talk about now.
Those I can't. There weren't that many. There were a couple, though. But one of them really, really made me angry, very, very angry personally, because was at the height of the military unit's success rate, when morale was high, everything was going right, and the CIA came to us and tasked us with finding a mole within their ranks.
Uh-huh.
And I assumed that when we found this person, I won't mention gender, when we found this person, that the person would be sent to prison. Well, we found the person, and
at
the person was murdered.
Murdered.
Yeah. And that, so I was an accomplice to a murder, and that really ticked me off. That really ticked me off.
Wow. That's something to think about. A lot of people believe, of course, that murder and assassination are not things that our government does.
The person was set up.
Is that
they were killed on farms?
Yes. Well, wherever they were killed, Nevertheless, Ed, is it naive to believe that our government doesn't do that kind of thing? We know they've done it in the past, so let's get that one out of the way right away. They say they don't do it now.
No, we don't do wet operations anymore, but that doesn't mean we can't subcontract.
Well, in a court of law, Ed, the subcontractor goes up the river just like the contractor.
As, not if they're foreigners.
Well... Yeah, I suppose that's a distinction, but it's not a big one. Still murder.
Mm.
Still the disposition by extreme measures,
mm-hmm.
whatever you want to call it. So it really does, whether it's by proxy or whatever, it goes on now too, right?
By proxy.
All right, if that distinction is really important.
Not in the end, it's not.
No, yeah. Not in the end, and not for the target, right?
No, certainly.
It was still dead as doornails.
There's only so many ways to die.
That's right. So the world still works in much the same way it did before. If you want to throw in an extra word to justify something, have at it. But it's
there's
still really the same
new
thing.
Under the sun. But there are more people. There are more people. Nothing new, but more people. So the percentages of things, good and bad, are higher than before.
Uh huh. All right.
There's still as much carnage and barbarism as the time of Vlad the Impaler.
Oh, there is, Ed. In fact, right now, our nation is on the verge of God knows what as a result of terrorism, 9/11, and the economy got kicked in the rear end, and it still has not come back to its feet. Our economy is in trouble.
It's going to get
one terrorist event, and so everybody, and me included, wants to know what's coming. With regard to terrorism, now you told us about the nuke in South Korea. Any major terrorist event, another one in this country, and most people believe the economy would stagger to a stop.
It you're not going to see another major terrorist event that's going to drive the economy down, but you're going to see something else that will take the economy out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems awfully fragile. It doesn't seem like it takes a whole lot to drag it down. What kind of event are you speaking of?
Avian-borne diseases.
What born?
Avian, birds.
Oh, bird-borne diseases.
Yeah. That, now, look at SARS. SARS was... We can control SARS for obvious reason. You essentially isolate... Quarantine populations of infected individuals, and because it's passed from human to human, and eventually it runs its course.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, Ed. And maybe it goes dormant with a season and comes back, too, like some other diseases we've seen. And maybe one of these times they don't manage to quarantine enough people.
Well, Art, you have to look at the reservoir of the virus. In this case, for SARS, it appears to be human. But let's just say for argument purposes that it's human, okay? What we're faced with now is something much, much more serious. Much more serious because we've got at least something like West Nile, if not West Nile itself, being transmitted by mosquitoes to birds and other animals. It's too cost prohibitive to control those two vectors. There's no way to do it. And it's going to spread fast with the warm weather, and it's already got a foothold here, West Nile at least, in the U.S., and a couple of more right behind it. That's what's going to take the economy down, that. Years ago on your show, years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, I said the cause of the next economic collapse of all things, and we thought it was so silly, I didn't even want to say it on the air. I said the cause of the next global economic collapse will be disease.
Well, I remember that. I remember
years
that very well indeed. We should dig it up from the archives and play it. No, you're absolutely right. You did certainly say that. And that's what I was trying to point out a little earlier. For whatever you've missed, you've had a lot of really big hits. It's just that your detractors tend to, like with the CIA, Ed, you know, they just go after the failures or the misses or the things that have not yet occurred, and they bring those to mind when they come after you. It's the normal human way to react to the kind of news that you give out. You know, news of catastrophes and disasters and the darker side of things. Major Ed Dames is my guest. I'm Art Bell from the High Deserts. Riding this horse throughout the night, known as Coast to Coast AM. Stay right there.
Presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And now, filling in for George, here's special guest host, Art Bell.
Here I am. How you doing? I'll never, ever forget the beginning of this movie, the TV version of The Stand. Did you see that? Do you remember that? This song was playing in the background. That's how they opened. And it showed a scientist standing in the lab. And, oops! And the vial hits the floor, and then it shows people on the base beginning to run for their lives, other people throwing up on the lawn. In other words, the beginning of the end of the world. That was some movie. It's kind of like listening to Major Ed Daines. We'll be right back. By the way, folks, my email addy remains the same, artbell@mindspring.com. That's all lowercase. Artbell, A-R-T-B-E-L-L, at mindspring.com. All right, my guest is Ed Daines, Major Ed Daines. And we're talking about some pretty rough-to-listen-to things, and he does work in areas that other remote viewers don't. So if this is overwhelming for you, and or if you have children about, I suggest you flip the radio off. Because it's going to be concerning. Listening to it is going to be a concerning thing for you, as it is me, because I happen to believe that remote viewing is real. A lot of people who I have a great deal of respect for in the scientific community also give it a gigantic amount of credibility. And once again, here's Major Ed Daines. Ed, welcome back.
Thank you. Art, before we send young ones off to bed, their parents can tell the kids to go to sleep with this on their mind. Readyourparentsmind.com and readyourteachersmind.com.
Really?
Those two websites will take children to a new ESP for kids kit that I've developed and beta tested over 2 years in high school and fifth grade science projects. I'm trying to train as many kids as possible, as fast and furious as possible, and this is a really effective kit for young kids.
Why are you trying to
do? They'll need these skills.
They'll need these skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll need these
to skills. Live, to survive. What do you mean?
That's a good start. Yeah. And it's easier to teach children. It's more difficult for reasons that we've talked about in the past because they don't have the lexicon and thesaurus to express what they're perceiving remotely or in their mind's eye. But they have far less baggage than you or I. They don't have an ego to have to tolerate. They're not conditioned, those kind of things. So they're pretty much a clean slate.
Is it really always a good thing, Ed, to know the future?
I'm not saying that they should know the future.
No,
they need to know where water is.
Yeah, I'm just asking you. Oh, I see. You're laying into the practical aspect of it, where you could find water or do some other thing that would save your own life.
Yeah, or simple things like, you know, solving a problem, going right brain. I'm working with a very famous scientist in Japan right now who has hundreds of thousands of young students that he's taught photo reading to. And we're working hand in hand in Japan and in China to teach young people these skills. And I want to do the same thing in America because it's my home country.
Along with these practical skills comes the ability to let the mind adventure with questions that almost every walking, breathing human being wants the answer to, right?
Absolutely. Brave New World.
Brave New World. And so, is it always good to know the future? And do you think, I mean, you must have wondered about this a lot. I mean, are there some things better just not known?
I think so, and you do. We do. I agree with you. I think your question is actually a statement, and I agree with you. And yes, this is a Pandora's box, but what would a world without secrets be like? Anything's better than what we have now.
There is that, yes.
So,
I suppose. There is a song that says, "Tell me lies, sweet little lies." I mean, there are a lot. There's a big part of the population, Ed, that doesn't like bad news. And frankly, a lot of them, Ed, are your detractors. They don't like bad news. And when they get it, they get angry.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they respond. They respond with anger.
Well, I've seen it even with some of the most educated people I've met on the planet.
You bet. It's a natural human reaction. If you don't understand something or it's beyond your ability to compute and to even think about and digest, then you reject it and you do so with anger. You lash out.
Suppose something lands that's more a higher intelligence and it does not look, it looks like the Ferengi or something worse. Now, if we approach these entities with this kind of attitude, that's not an attitude that's going to get us anywhere out there in the galaxy.
Well, I'm not convinced yet that we're headed to the galaxy.
And if we ever make it. It's not one that's going to be popular.
It's not a guaranteed ride at all.
No.
Not the way we're going at the moment. No. And by the way, while we're on the subject of something like that landing, I just read a very interesting book, Ed. Really an interesting book. The concept was that the United States had begun to disintegrate into civil unrest and civil war and acts of terrorism by our own. We've already experienced a little bit of that, but I mean on a massive scale, so massive that the president in this novel is forced to concoct an alien threat, actually construct a ship with organisms on board that would pass muster after the crash, and they simulate a crash and about 10,000 people are killed by this gas let off by this spacecraft as it crashes, and so the president at the time, with an approval rating of plus one or something terrible like that, actually manages to turn the entire country around. A lot of people have to die for this to happen, but all of a sudden now we have a common enemy, something to be scared of that's seemingly beyond us right now. And I wonder if you imagine anything like that's ever been considered.
Oh, it doesn't have to be, that fantasy doesn't have to be entertained. We're going to have the real thing here in the summer as it begins.
All right.
Microbes.
Yes, all right. Now let me make sure here that we're talking about something that you have remote viewed. Is this an event you have remote viewed?
Yes, avian-borne diseases. Next up in terms of a catastrophe.
Okay, well, I read a story recently that we are being bombarded, I mean us as in Earth, with alien organisms all the time. They're crashing into Earth, you know, in the forms of meteors with some organic matter from some place or another with some little bug. Is that what you mean, or do you mean that we're going to be targeted by an alien intelligence on
Earth? No, absolutely not. I'm talking about an epidemiology here, right? A foreign, yes, an alien virus, because it was indigenous to Africa for many, many years. Having jumped ship on an airliner, made it to the U.S., and now it has an inroad, it's got its teeth in the East Coast, and it's going to spread fast via mosquitoes and birds. And to mammals, very quickly.
And to mammals. And will it mutate?
It doesn't really have to mutate. It'll take mammals so long to build up by, you know, natural selection, immunity to it that it'll be able to eat a lot before it has to mutate. So, you know, West Nile virus, maybe African equine encephalitis, things like that, not won't take long. It doesn't have to mutate.
Well, you have made these predictions now for many years. In fact, there was one that involved mother's milk. You recall that?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that's a little bit further on over the horizon.
Is it?
We reach a point where we get a grand slam, and there's a mass cull and all of that kind of thing. But later on, and this we need to talk about this in the context of cattle mutilations as well.
Really?
I will say that a point's going to be reached because of not viruses, but prions.
Mad cow disease.
Mad cow, chronic wasting disease, and
yes.
The human variant, Creutzfeldt Jakob. A point's going to be reached where we're not going to be able to trust milk because of these things. We don't want to transmit that kind of stuff, not to mention other things in milk.
This is also a prediction that you made many years before mad cow showed up. Or anything like it. I see that you have been right. I really do want to stick up for you for the haters out there. I mean, he really did predict this, folks. So it's going to sharply increase now. And again, the old hard question timeline, already we see these diseases beginning to emerge. But, we're talking about something that you use the word cull, right?
Well, the cull is going to happen two ways. One, we're right now, as you know, culling elk herds, and the British have culled a lot of cows.
Yes.
It's going to happen here in America, and the point's going to be reached where the cull is going to be so great that dairymen are going to have to take down their herds. That means no milk for babies. So, you know, just that's over the horizon, not too far. But that has nothing to do with the avian-borne viruses right now.
So. Mm-hmm. This you view as on top of us virtually?
Yes, yeah, this summer. Mm-hmm. Watch this summer.
Oh, this summer.
Yeah, watch.
And how bad, how fast?
Not sure, Art. I just know it's catastrophic in many ways in terms of the economy. Lots of money are going to have to be poured into this, and the Center for Disease Control is not going to be able to cope with it.
It looked to me like this recent thing we've just been through. If we're all the way through it, I'm not even frankly sure that we're all the way through SARS at all. I mean, it's suddenly sort of now out of the headlines for the moment, but I have this feeling we're not done with SARS, or SARS more likely is not done with us.
No, but Art, it can be controlled again because
it would appear as though they got it under control. It's amazing, but I feel like the other shoe is going to fall.
The other shoe is the avian-borne diseases, Art, because again, here in the case of SARS, we're talking about humans transmitting it to another human. Human-to-human contact is required.
Yes.
Okay. Isolate and quarantine a group, let the disease run its course, treat the people, and then it's gone. But in the case of avian-borne diseases, birds that have been bitten by a mosquito that's transmitting a virus, it's economically unfeasible, absolutely outside of the realm of any economic practicality to control that. And birds fly very far, very fast, and they transmit it to other mosquito populations that are all over the place. So if this spreads, if this happens quickly, and it will, just hold on to your hat.
I wish that we could have some understanding of scale. I mean, that should be the kind of thing that you could remote view. If not when, then at least scale. I mean, you see.
Yes, we can do that. I need my team to do that. And I can't afford to hire them to do that because they're being paid to do other things right now, and I don't have the personal funds to do that. We have other contracts we're running.
Yeah, I understand that you all don't sit around running the kind of topics that are of great interest to this audience all the time. You have a money side of the business. I tend to forget that. What kind of, without being specific, which I'm sure you couldn't, what kind of jobs are you being paid to do? What type of jobs? I mean, if you don't want to tell me about one, then just tell me something that would be just like what you're doing, so I'll understand what occupies your time.
Well, I'm an educator, for one thing, so I teach workshops. I have one coming up this weekend in Las Vegas, in Seattle, and San Diego, and each month I teach a workshop on remote viewing. But the paid paid contract right now is with, one of them is with the largest book publishing company in Japan. And they are contracting my team to do a book on to forecast the Japanese economy in each sector.
Really?
Yes. A big book, a very, very big book.
Well, I was about to ask you if there was more money in actually going about and talking about remote viewing than there was actually in the remote viewing itself.
Yes, there's a lot of money to be made there, but I refuse to do it. That's not how I want to spend my life, just a talking dog. I love my work, and talking is great, you know, to people like you. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, I do too.
But I couldn't do it too long without being. I need to work. I love my job, so it's getting out there on the ground. We've been really succeeding in Japan. I'm a big star on Japanese television now. Every month I have a big special.
Oh, yes, something about you being on Japanese TV every month.
Yeah, a big special on Asahi TV Channel 10. I'm pretty well known in Japan now. And that's what, look, the Japanese television, the entertainment industry, has paid me to do what I've wanted to do in the States, and that is to locate missing children and to solve child murders. And so that's what I've been able to do in Japan.
Do you find more cooperation from government officials, local police, agencies of varying sorts in Japan than you do here?
I have everything I want there.
Really?
Even the parents are so thankful for anything that my team and I can do, anything. The police, the media, everybody. In the States, I have to do it clandestinely.
Yes. Why do you think there is such a large difference? What is it about our nature that makes you look like the Wicked Witch of the West here in the West?
I'm not quite sure. It could have been mistakes I've made in the past, and the situation has been greatly compounded by a group of psychics, a remote viewing group of psychics that terribly botched, a child search, Elizabeth Smart child search, and that has just about erased any hope of getting law enforcement on my side here in the States for the next couple of years. That's why we have to succeed a lot in Japan, take those successes back to American law enforcement, especially the FBI, before we can make some inroads here. But, boy, it's been tough going, really tough going here in the States. I have one more case left in the States, and I have to run it clandestinely and sneak around to find the child's bones because I'm not getting any support from anybody on this case.
But yet in Japan, you get all kinds of support. What's the record over there so far? How are you doing?
Oh, we're doing exceedingly well in terms of locating a hit-and-run, a 7-year-old child hit-and-run victim, describing the automobile, where the hit and run, where the driver works, those kinds of things, locating the body of an infant. We're doing exceedingly well there. I've got everything I need.
Ed, what went wrong with the Elizabeth Smart case? Where did the team and how did the team go wrong?
They didn't have the expertise. They tackled something they could not solve. They did not have the expertise to solve. They never were trained in advanced skills in terms of setting a problem up and correctly analyzing it, and their egos got in the way. I have fired more people because their egos exploded. Because remote viewing is a very empowering thing, Art. When you can do this, you are hot stuff. And, you know, I've even had to check my own many, many times.
Well, no, I just bet you have. Because, we've talked about that before. One thing shines through with you, Ed. You're not the shy, retiring type. You've got a pretty good-sized ego.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep that out of your work?
You got to. You must. Once you put that pen on the paper and you start working the way that we start as remote viewers, as professionals, you better have that ego out of the picture because you're not going to be able to control your imagination and you're not going to be able to stop the judgment of the incoming data and you're going to crash and burn. You can strap your ego back on.
Well, then you've got to be Dr. Jekyll and Major Ed Dames.
Essentially, yeah. Everybody works the same way it's just like being an airline pilot. A pilot can have a big ego, but when they're in the cockpit of a 747 responsible for all those passengers, they better darn well toe the line and, you know, act the same degree of standards that every other pilot does. Once they get, you know, once the planes land and they're off, that's fine. Strap the ego back on. But there are standards here of performance.
How do you recognize when a remote viewer has his ego totally blocking any decent information? How do you know that?
They become emotionally unstable. You can see it. I had one that happened to me in Japan. One got caught up in the drama, lost his perspective, had serious personal problems, and had to be let go. Very serious personal problems that he needs to attend to. So I had to replace him with
show up in their work?
They lose the target. They begin to go all over the place. They can't maintain consistent data.
In other words, all the discipline the military instilled, hold on, Ed, we're at a break point, breaks down totally, and you're no longer with the team. You're out there on your own limb. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM. In the darkness, I'm Art Bell. Everybody, Major Ed Dames is here, and I had to figure a way to get this in. Year of the Cat, love this song. And I absolutely love saxophone, and there is a piece of this that for me just sort of sets the brain cells all lined up together and working in perfect unison. It's just, it's perfect saxophone. And it's right here. It's kind of nice.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Filling in for George, tonight's special guest host is Art Bell. To talk with Art, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. East of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. And west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling the AT&T International Operator and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. Now, for George Norrie, special guest host, Art Bell.
George, enjoying a week of vacation, and believe me, when you do a program like this, you need it. Every now and then, you need it. Batteries have to recharge, because there's a lot of discharge that takes place. Major Ed Dames will be right back. Stay put. One thing that I've always been extremely curious about is what our animals think of us and what they think about in general. And I wonder if Ed Dames, Major Ed Dames, has ever remote viewed anything that would give him a hint of what it is that animals think, if they have a consciousness, if they have a soul, if they, or if they don't. I mean, I just wonder, Ed, if you've ever done any work with animals and could tell us anything about any of that.
Not esoteric work like that, but yes, I had a fascinating contract with some dolphin researchers once years ago to assist their studies of dolphins in the wild.
Really?
That was very fascinating. And dolphin communications. They needed some insight as to how to communicate with dolphins, and that was one of my favorite all-time projects.
Well, did you determine that a dolphin has a thinking process as we understand it, or are they, you know, entirely different organisms to the degree that we wouldn't even grasp the way they, in quotes, I guess, think of things?
No, it was close enough so that we could, there was enough commonality and overlap so that we could fathom what was going on in their little dolphin minds.
Really?
But the way they were processing information was what was interesting to me, because we think of them as acoustically oriented.
Yes.
They're very vocal animals, and yet, when you remote view it, it turns out that visually they're far more adaptive and responsive than they are acoustically, far more. And so I developed a protocol for a human-dolphin interaction that was based on visuals rather than...
So their eyesight means more to them than the acoustic abilities.
Yes, they're extremely inquisitive. As they become conscious in the morning when they wake up, for instance, anything that's changed in the water, even a small thing, will be immediately recognized and investigated.
Why have they befriended, in some cases, saved human beings?
I don't know, Art. I never remote viewed that or tried to gain any insight there.
Did any insight into the nature of the way dolphins think give you any clue about that?
Yes. No. Only the way they, yes, in terms of the way they process visual information and integrate it. Beyond that, in terms of what we would call higher ideation or thought, whether they cogitate or dream or ratiocinate when they're sitting around or swimming around.
Well, I've just sort of always wondered whether it was a semi-natural reaction. They see a human in the water. They know what a shark can do instinctually, of course. They know very well what a shark can do and does every waking fin-flapping moment. And so they would understand that that human or that biological entity flopping in the water is about to get gobbled. And I just wonder, do they make a conscious moral decision to save that human and help, or do they just react instinctually as they might with any other creature in that situation?
Well, my knee-jerk reaction would be it's instinctive, but I'm always wrong in my knee-jerk reaction. This is why I love my work, because when you use remote viewing, you bypass all the judgments and the imagination, and you get to the direct knowledge. But I have not looked at that, and there's so many things, Art, to...
Take a look at a cat for me, will you?
Which one?
No, it doesn't have to be a specific cat. Pick a cat.
Yes, it does. In our work, it does.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Speaking of looking at something...
I'll send you a picture. A cat named Yeti. I want to know.
Okay. A picture would be better in that case.
All right. No problem.
Speaking of inspecting... The workshop I have coming up this weekend, I have one of the world's leading orthopedic surgeons in there. You might want to swing by and have him inspect your back.
Oh, my back. Yeah, it's giving me fits at the moment, actually, Ed.
I need to give the listeners an enrollment phone number for these workshops.
Absolutely. I always let you promo something. It seems like you're hot on workshops tonight. So a chance for the public to see and work with you, watch you work, do what?
No. It's strictly teaching. It's teaching a skill. We lock the doors. You come out with a skill.
Oh, okay. All right. Gotcha.
Don't come to these workshops unless you really want to learn this, because I'm going to make sure you do. I'll be standing right next to you when you do.
You know what? I've heard that from many of your students, Ed. I've had emails from all kinds of people who have been to your workshops, and they've got nothing but really good things to say. I'll sure give you that. I've had a lot of those kind of emails, Ed. So, all right. So, phone number for the workshops.
Yeah, if you want to enroll, it's toll-free 1-866-607-8439.
And what cities should be on the alert here?
I have workshops coming up, well, again, this weekend is a higher level one. So Seattle in July and San Diego in August. The reason I'm pushing these now is as I'm probably going to be turning my attention fully to children beginning this fall, and I'm not sure.
I know. You've been threatening to do that for years.
Well, I'm starting now with this kit, the ESP kit for young people. In fact, if you look at the cover art, you have to go through a website that says there's a policeman with a whistle. And it says, warning, information may be disturbing some adults. No one under 12 years, no one over 12 years of age may enter this website without, that kind of thing. Adults must be accompanied by kids. And then you'll see the cover art for the August release of Mind Dazzle Kids Kit. Or if they can go to remoteviewing2003.com and get links to the enrollment and to the kids kit.
All right. But particularly if you're in one of those cities, the number to call is 1-866-607-8439.
Right. Seattle, Las Vegas, San Diego.
Yeah, I still have not made up my mind whether or not I really ever want to give it a try at. Still haven't made up my mind.
Well, you know, I got to tell you something about, I'm not going to mention his name, but this world's leading orthopedic surgeon took the workshop because he had a neuropathy that's killing him. He was dying from this mimic Lou Gehrig's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And none of his colleagues, which are the world's best like him, could diagnose the cause of this. And so I personally and two of my team members remote viewed an effective cure and treatment for this disease. He's very happy.
I'm sure he's a happy camper indeed.
Mm-hmm.
All right, look, prior to your appearance tonight, we had Stan Dale on. Stan wove a tale from a man he had talked to, which frankly sounds just like, Ed the Hopi. It sounds like a Hopi prophecy. It sounds like things you've said in the past. It sounds like things Gordon Michael Scallion has said. Geologic massive disturbance of some sort that will leave many, many dead, California into the ocean, all that sort of thing. What do you feel about that? I mean, I know you deal with disease and other things that are coming to us and are obviously happening right now. But what about that geologic kind of earth change stuff, Ed?
My feeling is, I firmly believe that in our lifetime, at least mine, I don't know about yours, but our lifetime, just kidding, that we're going to see, believe it or not, a honest-to-God pole shift that will be as catastrophic as the one that sank that city off the coast of Cuba.
That's another thing Stan told me. I can't recall now whether it was on the air privately, but a pole shift, yes, you mentioned that.
Well, let's call it a pole shift. The Earth's going to turn or wobble or precess on its axis, and it's going to do the same type of thing that caused that city to be that far underwater.
You refer to the one off the coast of Cuba,
I
presume, 2,200 feet down.
Yes. Now, this, I'm always I'm reticent to talk about these kind of things because people, even who are pushed the envelope, like myself, tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater here.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of predictive intelligence, I'm going to have to stand by this as well as the Korea nuclear device.
Well, there was Ms. Leader who not only killed me off on her website, but had talked of killing off most humans because of Planet X, which never did arrive on schedule, either one of them, as far as I know. She did get me, though. But
well,
this
is a reality.
Planet X never did hit when she said it would hit. Now, is Planet X, is it in fact a reality? And if so, where is she? And when's she coming around the corner?
I don't know. It is a reality, and it does appear to be the causative agent for this precess or this wobble.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite sure. It's so difficult to We're looking at an unprecedented geophysical event, and it's very, very difficult. But there is a passing space body.
Well, there's a lot more than Ms. Leader to say that that may be the case. Scientists, in fact, have spotted an object that's a burned-out sun or a large dark planet. They don't know what out there. And then, of course, there is Mr. Sitchin that I've had the pleasure of interviewing. And there's a lot, I think, to that. And a lot of ancient things say it happened before.
I think that what's so difficult to fathom for me and others is that it's such an infrequent thing in terms of geological time and human history.
Mm.
Human history. We can't see much further back than 9,000 years in terms of culture. What happened past that? I guess we all had a culture all of a sudden magically.
It's kind of a cosmic blink of the eye, really, our existence, just very short time.
But I think the Hopis are right. Many cultures are right. This is the end of the fourth world, beginning of a new and younger world. And then this will be, what I have done is remote view what will presage and announce this, the earth turning. Because I'd like to know when this is going to happen.
So would I.
Prepare.
So would I. And what will presage it?
Extreme weather events. Violent, violent weather events. Very, very
Gee,
fast.
Isn't it good that we're not having that?
Well, we're not having it the kind of way that I'm seeing it in terms of remote viewing. It's going to happen really fast and furious, as if the Earth's magnetic field is changing or something like that.
Oh, that's another good point that we should cover here in a moment, the Earth's magnetic field changing.
But anyway, when you see those kinds of events really back-to-back and drastic, head for high land.
Well, how much more drastic than we have now? We have cells doing... the whole season has been terrifying. I watch it daily on the maps.
Wow.
These incredible, incredible long nation-covering storm fronts, Ed, that are producing tornadoes everywhere they go and destruction in their path all the time. So some of the rubble is being tossed around because it's already rubble, just rubble being tossed around. It's horrible what's going on.
Uh-huh.
And so if you're saying this is nothing compared to what's coming?
Right. On our first show over 7 years ago, I told you in that two-hour show that soon there will be no more seasons, and we will not be able to grow crops the way that we've grown them in the past.
Yes, you did.
And so, and by the way, crops are going to start failing for a number of different reasons, but that's next season. So, just get ready. This is a grand slam and a mass call, and make some accommodate it.
Now, when you say crops will begin failing next season, that's pinning it down pretty hard, and it's something you can be called on. Is this something you again, just to be sure, Ed, that you remote view that crops will in fact begin failing next season?
And let me reiterate, they're beginning to fail now for weather reasons.
Uh-huh.
But and no, not next season necessarily, but very soon they'll begin to fail for other reasons, particularly because of pathological reasons, in terms of mold and fungi.
You still stand by all you said about something coming out of Africa?
Absolutely. Totally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you seem to have been very constant about that.
The reason, Art, is because some things are so big. For instance, this idea of this pole shift, let's use that.
Okay.
The end of time in terms of the Mayan calendar or whatever.
Oh, is that what you're going to call it, the end of time? You do have that written down here and something you sent me, the end of time, and I went, huh? The end of time.
Yeah, I like that term because I used to think the Mayan calendar, just ran out of room at around 2012 or so and just stopped there. But now I realize that was very, very incorrect. That literally for them, the end of one era, the end of a tulpa, and the beginning of the next, and it's right about now. What I think is so interesting is that we're born into this time where it's happening. That is fascinating. As I've said before, lots of opportunity for character development lies.
Well,
right,
again, not to pick on your timeline problem again, but I mean, how can you know for sure? Do you know for sure,
yes,
Ed?
Yes.
You do.
The reason we know is because hundreds of remote viewing sessions looking at individuals' optimum trajectories, what would be most fulfilling to them in terms of vocation,
yes,
mate, those kinds of things like that, put them all underground. In other words, their unconscious is saying to them, as well as the collective unconscious, you don't have a trajectory. You don't have a mate. You don't have a vocation. You don't have any of these things unless you survive. And the only way you can survive is to go over here, be in a hole. Because when it's...
Be underground. Again, something you have said for years and years and years, that we're going to end up, for some reason, underground.
For a while.
Living underground.
Well, no, no, to wait out storms are. To wait out storms. Because if the earth turns, not only do you have inundation, but you've got, because, again, because the coefficient of friction between the atmosphere and the mantle is so loose, you have a few days for all that energy to catch up into the atmosphere. When the atmosphere, you, again, just think of an egg that's not cooked. When you spin it really fast on a table, it takes a moment for the shell to start spinning because the friction, the coefficient of friction between
that's right, eggs. Yes, yes.
So when all that energy is translated into the atmosphere, the wind is going to pick up. Now, I've talked to NOAA scientists in Boulder about National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration scientists about this. I've asked them to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations for me on, let's say, a 12-degree pole shift. So essentially, you're going to get 300-mile-an-hour winds picking up and lasting for a week and a half, 2 weeks, and then dying down gradually. That's why people are underground.
Well, that'll take things right down to the ground. If you had a 300-mile-an-hour wind, they're going to be island wipers. I mean, you know, things that only mainland wipers. Whatever a 300-mile-an-hour wind tears over, it takes with it. I mean,
I live on the islands. I live in the Hawaiian Islands, and when even 130-mile, 120-mile-an-hour wind still in the island of Kauai has left, it's still never recovered from a storm 15, 20 years ago.
Yes. And further out in the Pacific, where typhoons have a longer time to build, I've seen them dealing, Ed, with 200-plus mile-per-hour winds. You know, once a typhoon...
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Once it's built all the way across the Pacific, you can get hit on Wake Island or, you know, the Philippines or any of the coastal areas in Southeast Asia or even Asia can get slammed with just monster typhoons.
Well, we're not talking planet-wide now because we don't know the zones of inundation. We don't know the zones, but we can remote view sanctuaries. We can do that for ourselves and for others. So we know, for instance, and I've said this many times, one of the places that you need to be are high or very far inland. There's got to be a lot of fresh water. There's got to be protection where you can get on the ground. And you need to be around people that aren't going to rape, plunder, and pillage when the lights go out.
Well, that's another topic, and one we should cover here in a moment. Those who will rape, plunder, and pillage. Major Ed Dames is here. Good morning. I'm Art Bell.
It used to be so nice, it used to be so good.
premier radio networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And now, filling in for George, here's special guest host, Art Bell.
Here I am. Good morning, everybody. Of course, Major Ed Dames is here, and we'll try and get some calls this hour if we can. You've got the numbers, and all you've got to do is pick it up and use it, so we'll fit some questions in. But in a moment, I have a few more of my own. Stay right where you are. Rape, plunder, and pillage. I've often wondered about that. You know, if there was some sort of geographic seismic event that would cause the economy to crash, or whether it was a bug that is coming that the major has talked about, or anything else, that would cause a major disruption in the force, i.e. our economy tanking and there being blood in the streets and rape, plunder, and pillage. I've often wondered, Ed, what kind of percentage of the people would begin engaging in that kind of activity with that kind of news?
You wonder that and you ask it, but I know what's uppermost on your mind right now.
Do you?
And it's not that. Yes, and during the break, I just did a little exercise here and I addressed that. I wanted to know what's uppermost on your mind. I know that you have a certain agenda to deal with the show, but I wanted to take a look to see what was really there to show you how practical this could be.
What, pray tell, have you found?
That antenna of yours hanging right there is such a big thing. I sketched your antenna.
Well, you know what, Ed? Okay, we'll get into this in a second, but that's not a hard call, Ed, because I've been talking about almost nothing else.
Yes, you have, but it didn't occur to me that it would be. I was thinking it would be something like your cat or Ramona or something like that, but there it was. I sketched this friggin' antenna.
Oh, man, my antenna. Don't you call my antenna that. No, it's been an important part. It's been something I designed and...
But that's what I used to do when I...
Sweated blood over?
If I needed to know if a spy was recruitable, an agent, as a spy master, I needed to know if, let's say, a foreign scientist would be ready to sell out his or her country. And I had to do these kind of things, use remote...
Well, it's not quite on that level. but yeah, blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, a good friend of mine says no project worth doing ever completes itself without... personal injury, you know, and so I've got a lot of myself into this.
Back to your question.
So you've sketched this out, you've looked at it. What do you know?
No, I just know how the darn thing is huge. I haven't been on your property, but my God, it looks
huge,
like if Premiere ever goes down, they don't have anything to worry about. You can pick up the programming.
I don't even know where to go from here.
They ain't got nothing on this.
you know, you want a task? Do you want a task, Ed?
Absolutely. God knows I love challenges, and you know that I do.
Put enough pictures of my antenna up. It's like a baby, you know. Hey, you want to see my antenna? So you might look into why I have this anomalous, incredible voltage on the antenna. It is a genuine mystery.
Oh, I'd be glad to do that.
And
I'd be glad to do that. See, that's pretty easy to do. I mean, it wouldn't take more than, let's say, 2 hours max of my time alone and easier. But yeah, I'd be glad to do that.
All right.
It's just standing there, and it's not RF.
All right. That's right. It certainly isn't. It's a mixture of AC and DC, and it's about 400 volts, enough to knock you on your butt, because it's knocked me on my butt a few times. So I've taken care of it. It's not a big deal now. I mean, it's shunted to ground, and I'm just using the antenna purpose, which it was designed for.
But it shouldn't have been there in the first place, is what you're saying.
No, Ed. It appears to be voltage out of the blue, you know, out of nowhere. And that's a very interesting prospect. I still have a lot of testing to do. But, yes, it's an intriguing prospect. And, after all, it might even be zero-point energy, something I'll be talking about with tomorrow night's guest. It might be. Who knows? Who knows what it is? But it's interesting enough that... If you feel like it, Ed, I'll supply you with some pictures.
No. I don't need the pictures. I already have chain of custody that you've told me what it is.
You mean you've taken my antenna? What do you mean chain of custody?
You've told me. I'm from my mind to your mind, I have chain of custody on the problem. And you've explained it to me and articulated it enough that I have no problem knowing what I need to do.
Huh.
At all.
Well, that should be extremely interesting. All right, look, back to something that will interest all, and that is you mentioned, we said aliens, and you kind of fluffed over it a little bit by talking about organisms, those which might be coming, and in fact, they're alien in a way, but you know what, Ed, I really want to ask you about aliens, the real thing. Aliens as in intelligence from another planet, not at the microorganism level, but real aliens with real spacecraft visiting here. Has that happened? Will that happen? Is that going to happen? Is that our future to meet another race from somewhere else? Is it going to happen?
Yes, it is. After this big slam dunk, we are going to meet another race. They're coming here.
Will they have any part at all in affecting what's going to happen to us in any way? Do they even care? What do we know about them, if anything?
That is the subject of my personal project, Starman, and has been. And,
right.
Starman is specifically seeks, it's geared toward evoking or reducing or eliciting a confrontation with one particular agency that affected one particular event in South Africa. And that's what Starman is focused on. And we're squeezing as much of our IQ as possible out to elicit this confrontation. And it turns out that people are the key. Every time we've been in the field to attempt to gain contact with this particular agency, we've brought instruments and some of the best scientists in the world. And what this agency has done, this alien agency has done, is tweak our instruments, whatever we brought in. It's tweaked our instruments, whether it's been infrared or ultraviolet or electromagnetic in any way, shape, or form, or microwave. It's turned those instruments on. So it's just playing with us. So we've learned a lot in the last 10 years about what to do and what not to do and how to elicit contact. People are key. People and others, and knowing where to go. Because if you don't know where to go, they know that you don't know how to do what they need for you to do, which is, for all intents and purposes, how to use consciousness to contact them. You have to find a place where they will meet, and you have to bring the right people there. So,
are either animal mutilations, the two most inexplicable continuing reliable phenomena we have, animal mutilations and crop circles, frequently mentioned together, I think, for that reason. They're both totally inexplicable right now, unless there is some sort of perhaps alien involvement or spiritual involvement that is truly beyond our understanding. Are they connected to an alien presence?
They're connected to an oversight, yeah. And what you can call, let's call it extraterrestrial. I really hesitate to use the word alien. Let's call it extraterrestrial for now, okay? They are indeed connected to the same agency. And the message is being lost in the meaning. By that I mean, in no uncertain terms, these elaborate, beautiful sculpted agroglyphs and these very elaborate, laid-out, butchered calves and cows are very noticeable. They're getting our attention, correct?
Certainly are.
Now, what's the meaning of those two things? What would be the meaning of, let's say, a very elaborate crop circle to you?
My thinking about crop circles is that many of them I have seen, in fact, a couple being previewed tomorrow night are more examples. I mean, there is no way in hell, Ed, that they were done by human beings.
I agree. Now, what would
there's
mean?
No way.
I understand.
Okay, I can't take it much further than that.
What would it mean to the farmer?
A pain in the butt.
Why?
Because people would come and trample through his field. It's happened time and time again. Some farmers won't even report it because they're so sick of people trampling their fields and the crops down.
And if there were no people to come, if the farmer didn't report it, what would be the meaning to the farmer? Smashed wheat?
An annoyance, I suppose. Probably not a whole lot more. I mean, I doubt that it decimates a large percentage of the crop it appears in.
Some of them do. Some of them take out a lot of wheat, a lot of sorghum.
Well, then, okay, he's going to be angry.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the meaning, if you strip away all the elaborate aesthetics, you have smashed crop.
Yeah.
Okay? And the meaning to a cattle rancher or a dairyman who has lost what their prize animal is what? They don't care about aliens or anything else like that. They have just lost meat.
That's right.
So that's the message. Dead meat and dead crops. That's what's coming. It's a forecast of what's to come. No crops.
Oh, you think it's that direct a message?
Yes, I do.
All right. Stop again and ask you, is this something you know as a result of what you have remote viewed?
Yes, it is.
Okie doke. So you're saying that the meaning of crop circles, the meaning of animal mutilations, is as simple as it appears. The ruination, the death of crops, the death, the trampling of crops, and the death of meat.
I couldn't put it any better myself.
It's a funny thing, Ed. I never stopped to imagine it might mean something that literal.
Either did I. I had the remote viewer. Like, but it's our attention, whatever is out there, can't land and lay it out to us. For some reason, it has to use these parables.
Okay, if that's the message, then why the intricate designs? Why not just flatten some fields? I mean, then you really get the blunt message through, I suppose. I mean,
because then it could be equally construed as being human.
Because
right now,
they're so intricate, because they're so amazing, so many of them, the human brain naturally wants to attribute a more complicated a message to them.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
It's what we reach out to try and do, to try and make sense of things. I never even for a second thought, well, it just means that crops are going to get smashed. And
it's an attention-getting device, yes. If they kept doing the same thing all the time, look, for instance, UFO, flying saucers.
Yes.
If that phenomenon did not change its appearance by the same oversight, by the same agency, the controlling agency, we would just look up and not pay any attention to it anymore because the novelty would be lost. We fall into an ennui. Well known in experimental psychology, novelty acts as a stimulus. But it morphs. One day it's torpedo shape, one day pyramid shape, one day triangular, one day this, one day that, one day a chupacabra here, one day a Bigfoot there.
Yes.
The message is we're not alone. That's the message.
That's the blunt message there too,
yeah.
Huh?
That's the blunt method.
We are here.
And Hollywood well knows this. You know, you better not do the same thing every movie. Make bigger, louder, more. Today, blow up a bus. Tomorrow, a city. Then a planet. Then a galaxy. You know, that kind of stuff. You got to do something better or you'll lose your audience.
Huh. Well, then we better get ready for some really big show in the skies because, after all, we have the Phoenix Lights and some, you know, pretty spectacular things like that, whatever they were.
Art, I agree. I agree. Get ready. Get ready.
What, do you have any idea of how it might manifest itself when it really lets go with the next spectacular or, you know, four or five times from now when it really lets go?
Well, because it's a real phenomenon, we can actually remote view it. We can look at the next sequences of events.
And, yes.
But that would have to, we'd have to actually do it. I think it would be fun to do it, but it would just be fun. And unfortunately, I have precious little time to have fun these days.
I mean, it would be interesting to know that something will make an appearance over Washington or New York or, you know, something really massive or, you know, the old saucer on the White House South Lawn thing or whatever.
There's so many of them, though. I actually am more interested in the voltage on your antenna than I am.
I don't know why. I mean, this is a very interesting question. We are being visited. I would like to know why. I'd like to understand what it is that motivates those who visit us.
Well, I
picked one of them. Their intentions toward us? You
pick it. I told George Nuri this when I did a show with him.
Yes.
Project Starman is centered around one specific event, and that's at the Ariel School, 1996, in Zimbabwe. And John Mack was there to interview the school children. They were called out somehow into the woods to confront a typical CE3, Close Encounter of the Third Kind. That event is this, is that I want to gain contact with the agency that orchestrated that particular event, not all of the various and sundry sightings and all those other Close Encounters of the Second Kind. Like, I want those guys.
The organization that orchestrated the event.
I want the agency that orchestrated that, because it was they sent a message to these children, these school, young school children, and it was essentially, your planet is dying and we're very sad. And all the school came back, and John Mack interviewed each one in very controlled conditions, and I got to see the original tape, which didn't make it out to the public. That had a big effect on me, and so I'm concentrating on getting behind the orchestrators and the engineers of that particular event. Only.
Does the remote viewing that you've done, Ed, lead to the same catastrophic conclusion that our planet is dying?
It's going to go fallow for a while. The garden's going to go fallow for a while. Yeah, that conclusion. And it's not going to be pretty as we go through the transitions, Mad Max scenarios and things like that. But it will eventuate in something that is pretty. And there will be another race here to help us rebuild, which is good.
Well, I know, but if you talk too much about the bright side on the other end there, wherever in the world that is, then you're going to sound like the New Agers.
I resemble that.
So I understand that somewhere down the timeline, it's all going to be great, and we're going to be walking around holding hands, and there will be no nations and borders, and no sickness and death and disease and taxes and whatever.
Right. I don't know about taxes, but
sometime between now and then, there's going to be some pretty rough ocean to be going through.
Oh well, yeah.
Maybe
hot time in the old times.
Maybe literally.
Yeah, hot time in the old town tonight.
Not
pretty. Not pretty, but, you know, it's, what are we? We focus on who we are a lot, our mind, what we think.
And we do, yes.
Things like that, but we don't know what we are. We have precious little time of what we are, and if we were to address the what at that level, you can't talk about it, and because we can't talk about it, and we're so vocally expressive left-brain creatures, we don't really get down to the essence of what we are. We spend most of the time on who we are, because the what stays and the who goes, and we don't nurture the what, and if we did, then the world would change pretty much pretty fast.
Well,
that's why I want to teach children, because I want them to know the limits of mind. Remote viewing, for instance, is a very powerful mind tool, but we're not all mind. There's another part of us. And you can't go there using your mind. And when you go there, I'm using that term very loosely, you can't transmit using words to other people what you are at that level. And we give short shrift to it unless you're a yogi or an enlightened being.
Is there, can you give us any clue about some of those larger questions, Ed? I mean, who are we, and what are we, and why are we here? It seems to me remote viewing would look at these questions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. The planet is a garden. That's why there's not going to be a massive nuclear war, or nuclear slugfest is not going to be allowed.
We are a garden.
We are a garden, and souls are being harvested from the garden.
Huh.
And that's what this place
that's
is.
That's so familiar. Somebody named John Lear told me that so many years ago, and I cringed then and I cringe now. We're a garden,
yeah,
and the crop is souls.
That's right.
And there would seem to be some ongoing dispute about who's the gardener.
There may be some poker playing at another level. Who knows?
Well, I'm talking about the concept of good and evil, God and the devil and Lucifer. And
the two poker players.
Yeah, the two, that's right. The two poker players. Who's holding the winning hand?
Don't know. It's outside of our can art.
Yeah.
We really can't. That's, we don't have that kind of power to know that. We're just pawns.
But there is intelligence, and they're sending us messages about what we're doing to ourselves, right?
There is. Our progenitors, yes, appear to be doing that.
All right. We'll be right back.
reasoning of his latest claim. He talked and talked, and I heard him say that she had the longest, whitest hair, the prettiest green eyes anywhere. And the reasoning of his latest claim. Though I smiled at tears inside of a burning, I wished him luck and then he said goodbye. He was gone but still his words kept returning. What else was there for me to do but cry?
From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, filling in for George. Tonight's special guest host is Art Bell. To talk with Art, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. East of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. And west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling the AT&T International Operator and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. Now, for George Norrie, special guest host, Art Bell.
Tis I. Good morning, everybody. Major Ed Dames is here, and we're going to turn the telephones here in a moment and let you ask him questions. So keep it parked right where you've got it. Good morning. The sun has raced across the continent of Europe and Africa and the Pacific Ocean, and the sun is presently coming up in eastern Canada and the state of Maine, going into the gray area just prior to dawn, probably about now in Maine, and Major Dames is here this morning. And, Major, I've got an email here that I should read, came in during the show, from Mike and Juan, I believe it is. Just heard the Major say that he'll see the pole shift in his lifetime, but not sure about you. What the heck does he know that you might want to know? And I presume the intent of this email is to suggest that perhaps my lifetime is not consistent with yours in terms of span, but I don't want to know that myself, so I'm going to leave that part of it alone and simply ask you what you know about a pole shift, 12 degrees, you said, 300-mile-an-hour winds, you said.
I better be careful about how I... First of all, I said that was a joke.
I know. I heard you laugh.
Number two, I said hypothetically a pole shift of 12 degrees.
Yes.
Which, when we do... When professionals sketch this particular event, this wobble, this precess, it is a ballpark figure of 12 degrees. That's why I took 12 degrees to NOAA for their calculation.
We've already, in a worrisome kind of way, Ed, we've seen the pole wandering around a little bit. Magnetic North has taken some weird jaunts lately. It could be related to the sunspot activity or, you know, who knows what all. But it's done some pretty strange things of recent days.
The core of the Earth is changing. The core is changing. The core of the Earth is changing. And whether or not that's linked to solar activity, I'm not sure yet. But the core is changing. We keep looking at the superficial stuff, but it's actually the core of the Earth that's changing.
Hmm. Just like Gordon Michael Scallion. All right, I've got some calls lined up. People would like to ask you varying questions, so let's take the plunge. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames and Art Bell. Hey. Hello. First-time caller line, are you there?
Good morning.
Yes, good morning, sir.
Yes, sir. Good to have you back, Art.
Thank you.
And thank you, Major Ed Ames, for being there.
Pleasure is mine.
I have a question for you dealing with Planet X. Have you had an opportunity to talk to that Dr. James McKinney that George Norrie talked with? He's a physicist.
Negative. Have not.
All right. I was wondering... since he has gone into this in depth and he has presented a great deal of material, very upfront, very honest, and he is not a mouthpiece of the government. He's being very straightforward. I was wondering if there would be any possibility in the future if you would be able to talk with him and if you could give an update further down the road on future details and information.
All right, sir, let me interrupt you. This guest, whoever it was, I'm sorry, I don't know myself, does say that Planet X is real and so forth and so on. Is that the upshot?
Yes, sir, it's very real.
All right, well then, all you really need to know is what Ed also says, that Planet X is a reality, right, Ed?
Correct.
It is a reality, but you wouldn't be comfortable, I take it, in saying that June 1st and then June 15th and July 14th or whatever it is, the latest date, Planet X is going to collide and it's that close.
No, I would not. No. It's in our lifetime, and I would say any time between now. That's why I'm very suspect about the Mayan calendar. It's very intriguing. They appear to have been in touch with something and didn't have a lot of connecting rods and vortex generators and fax machines to worry about. So they had time on their hands to connect with something else. And I think they were connecting with this timeline that is more accurate than ours.
So you attach significant meaning to the end of the Mayan calendar beyond the fact that they just said, well, you know, that's far enough. What the hell?
Or they ran out of space.
Well, yeah.
On their steely.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Major Ed Danes. Hello.
Oh, hello. Good to talk to both of you. This is Evan from Seattle.
Yo, Evan.
Hey, my question is concerning the anthrax case of a while back. Last I heard, you all but handed the guy to the FBI. I believe it was a faculty member at Penn State. Is that correct?
College of Agriculture.
Okay, and it seems they've gone another direction or another searching at the bottom of lakes and whatnot. I just wanted to get your take on that, and also wonder if you think that is the man.
All right. In other words,
wonder if you think that is the man.
All right. In other words, the man.
All I can say at this juncture is that he was one of our own. He was a graduate student working for someone I knew, whose name I cannot mention. That was the last member of the offensive, of this country's offensive biological warfare program that was stopped in 1972. That's all I can say.
Can you say anything about the motivation of the person who sent out this poisonous terrorism? Why?
Yeah, we actually did a profile, a psychological profile of this guy. He was resentful. Resentful of the fact that he was. There's a lot to this, Art. I really don't want to go into the profile, but it's the profile of a typical disgruntled employee. It's sort of like going postal using another mechanism.
Is it like the occasional bad seed fireman that sets a fire?
Yes, very much so.
It's like that?
Yeah, it's that simple as well as that strange.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Danes. Hello there.
Thank you very much, Art.
You bet.
Art, this is Connor. I was at your Portland class.
Oh, yes.
I wanted to ask a question about Lucifer. I noticed a long time ago, remember Ed mentioning that he remote viewed Lucifer. And did you dismiss your former student, Aaron Donahue, because of his views on Lucifer, contradicting your views on Christianity?
He had to deal with and fix in his life, and it was causing problems in the field.
Okay,
he had to deal with and fix in his life, and it's causing problems in the field.
Okay, the viewing of Lucifer itself, I have long maintained, Ed, and I still do now, that it affected you, that you did not come out the same Ed Dames that went into remote view Lucifer. I noted a change in your personality. I heard it. I felt it. I heard in the intonation of your voice and the way you put things and said things and everything.
The thing was coldly, and it is cold and beautiful as ice, crystalline beauty, but ice cold, like it could absorb your soul if you were near it, just like a vacuum cleaner right into it. That's the only metaphor I could use to describe this thing, and it's like, you know, I do not want to be around it. Beautiful, just beautiful, crystalline type of entity in the mind's eye, but that if you were near it, it would suck the soul right out from you and you'd become part of it.
A very cold beauty.
Crystalline beauty, yeah. But
having described that, though, again, you were affected, Ed. You had to know that in some manner you were profoundly and perhaps permanently affected.
It created a kind of a sadness that in me that I really didn't want to know there was something like that in our part of the universe.
Uh-huh.
And an eternal type of a thing like that. I would have preferred a monad, just a creator and a loving universe and that kind of thing. I didn't want to find things like this, but very, very significant, powerful, not just an idea, it did have a form. So I know it's more than just an archetype or an idea per se.
You still haven't answered the question.
What was the question?
The question was about the change in you.
I've never felt that amount of power before in anything that I've ever looked at, whether as a remote viewer or as two eyeballs.
You're still not answering the question. The question is whether there was a profound, without even having to describe it, Ed, but a profound and perhaps even permanent change in you after that viewing.
What do you mean by change?
I don't know. I change in who you are and the way you present yourself and the things you say and the way you say them and your outlook on things and a change in you. How else can I put it?
There's a helplessness, yeah. I feel I'm more helpless than I've ever felt before when I think or about that. Yeah.
After being in the presence of that kind of power?
After being in the ideational presence of that. Yeah.
Well,
it's one of the few times in my career. Whereas, for instance, when I was looking at what was uppermost in your mind during the break, you didn't know at the conscious level that I was remote viewing. At an unconscious level, you do, but it didn't matter. It was such an insignificant thing. But this thing did. It knew I was looking at it.
Yes. Yes. Unimaginable. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Art?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I had tried to email you about... the contrails.
Yes.
And I just, I don't feel, I pretty much know now, and there was a lady that called in on the show about the ice age, and she said they're putting a gel and causing the drought. They're putting a gel in the sky and causing the drought. Well, yeah, it's called Dynagel, and it absorbs 2,000 times its weight in moisture, and it rains when it gets to the ocean. When it gets to the salt air, it causes it to rain. They've been doing it for 6 years. And by putting extra weight up there, it causes tornadoes, and it causes all sorts of different things. For instance, the jet streams change, and scientists don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Well, duh, you can't put weight in the atmosphere like that. And the plane, when I flew to California, they're doing it in California, too. And when I flew to California, I could kind of smell the motor heat up because it's going through that extra weight.
All right, let's boil this down and turn it around as a question for Major Dames, because it's one thing that I've asked about over a long period of time that until extremely recently the Major hasn't commented on, and that's what the chemtrails, what they are, what he knows about the chemtrails. That's one you've always dodged quite quickly, Major. Any care to comment?
Suppose we needed a global, suppose you don't know where the next missile is coming from. And this has been, as a tactician, this has been our problem for the last 20 years. You know, now all of a sudden a rogue state can get a hold of a missile, whether it's North Korea or whether it's the Russian mafia along with the Ukrainian military commander launching one or whatever. You don't know where it's coming from, so you need a global defense. And let's say, unfortunately, that your global defense, let's say for some reason you needed to modify the atmosphere, but that it would ensure that you could defend yourself against an attack from anywhere. Let's just say that.
Let's say it. Okay, let's say it.
But unfortunately, you erased the last 2.5 billion years of ozone layer development. When you do that, you screw around with that. So in a matter of 6 to 8 years' time, you're monkeying with something that took 2.5 billion years to achieve homeostasis and equilibrium. That's not good. So in the short term, you know, you accomplished your objective, but you may have done it in spite of yourself. That's a hypothetical situation.
A hypothetical, yes. So we are indeed trying to toy about with Mother Nature and try and change weather conditions.
Negative. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it has nothing to do with changing or modifying the weather. It may be something else.
But is that one effect of it?
Yes, but it's an artifact. It's an unfortunate consequence, an epiphenomenon of this.
Well, I know, but a pretty significant one, since we
exist like
down on the planet here on very small margins, you know?
Yeah, it'll be like, you know, treating a patient with chemotherapy or radiation therapy. It has some side effects, hair fall out, lethargy, that kind of thing.
Okay.
the cure may be worse than the disease.
Right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I think I know how he could remote view to give him his little window before the nuclear bomb goes off.
And
if he remote views the price of gold. No, just for, because they're doing it with silver now.
No, I chuckled, but I mean, it's really quite a good idea because...
Okay, you start at 350 like it is today.
Yep.
And you say, okay, will the price of gold be above or below 400 or above 400, say, by July 15th?
Yeah, it's a great
and
indicator.
If you do that, then you can go up or down.
We can't do that.
Or what if you were to look and see the price of gold at $12 or $13 or...
Well, you're just going 15 days out.
Yeah. That's the alphanumerics and calendrical time are abstracts. The price, for instance,
What am I saying, 12 or 13? $1,000, $1,200, $1,300, $1,400.
The idea...
Ed, do you have a radio on in the background? Or somebody did. All right. Well, anyway.
Totally abstract thing.
Well, in the case of gold, though, Ed, if there's a disaster, if something awful happens, the price of gold is going to go right up through the roof. It always happens, always.
Art, I understand. But what I'm saying is we can describe, as remote viewers, events that deal with physical things and emotions. But the idea of price has no meaning in the collective unconscious. It's totally an abstract idea.
Is that right?
Yeah. The idea of money... is abstract. The idea
abstract? I mean, what does that mean? If the idea of money is abstract 20 years from now, then that means there's not the same world at all that we have now.
That's not what I mean, Art. The idea of, let's say, calendrical time, Tuesday. What does Tuesday mean? What does $15 mean? It's a construct. And all that it means is itself. It's a tautology. There's no way to describe Tuesday for a remote viewer, as opposed to the source or the origin of the voltage buildup on your antenna, which is a physical thing.
Yes. So no matter how you might look, you would not be able to gauge, say, what the price of gold is going to be at any particular moment in the future that you might look at. Is that correct?
No, we can gauge its ups and downs in the future and the concatenation of ups and downs, but only in terms of physical phenomenon or emotional phenomenon. And physical is much better for technical reasons. But we can't. The price is meaningless to us. Meaningless.
So in this world in which you go fishing for information will not give you information on that sort of thing, which you say is utterly meaningless in that realm, abstract.
That's right. We have to go after physical phenomena and physical things, tangible things. We can describe physical things using abstract words, whatever we have in our lexicon or our thesaurus in our memory, but we can't do it the other way around.
Can you look at the near future and see if Point Sur is still where it's supposed to be?
Yes.
Above water?
Yeah, we can do things like that. We can look at near term or qualify our search term somewhat with a temporal qualifier.
All right. Listen, show's ending, so you're going to be in a few cities coming up. And what's the phone number again for information?
Our workshops are toll-free 1-866-607-8439 or go to remoteviewing2003.com. tell your kids, read yourparentsmind.com and read yourteachersmind.com. Watch those sites.
I wonder who picked the title of that one.
Wonder.
Readyourteachersmind.com. All right, Ed, it's been a pleasure as always, and when I'm back next, well, who knows, we'll talk to you again for sure.
Okay, stop by this weekend if you want.
Later, Ed. See you tomorrow night with Mr. Hutchinson and Linda Moulton Howe. It'll be quite a night. Till then, from the high desert, ciao.